I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film, Irish and international. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are...
Luke.
And Jason.
And so we're going to talk about the week in film news, the new releases, and the top 10. But let's begin by talking about what we normally talk about first, what we watched this week, or what we watched since last we talked. So what have you watched since last we talked, Luke?
Okay, well, we are going to get into this a bit later with our new releases, but I had seen that everybody on Twitter had been doing a... run the series of Mission Impossible. So I thought, to be a little bit different, and this was kind of best laid plans, I was going to try and watch The Way of the Gun, which is the first film directed by Christopher McQuarrie.
Which I've seen in the cinema when it came out because I'm 500 years of age.
I was frustrated in my efforts to find it, but I'm still going to try and track it down at some point.
It's remarkable because I was looking at McQuarrie's filmography and he seems to have disappeared for an extended period between that and Valkyrie, I think.
Yeah. He's very funny on Twitter because he was asked about what would he do different and he said maybe not making Way of the Gun because he kind of inferred that that might have been not a career end or such because I think it was quite well received at the time. I think I really liked it. Now, I haven't revisited and I don't know how kind time is to it, but I kind of really liked it when it came out.
I was doing my bit of research and it looked like kind of your late era Tarantino.
And
it's a bit smarter than I think, but it did have, Tarantino was certainly still casting a shadow in that regard.
And it seems like maybe Ryan Phillippe in kind of a lead role might have been a problem.
It's okay, but again, this is from 15 years ago when I probably not seen it, or about 10 years ago, so.
So I had been trying to track that down, and it didn't work, and so I was kind of in a frustrated effort to find something to watch that had some kind of vague connection to action. So I went on a little dive into Netflix, and I found a film called What Happened to Monday? I don't know if you know this.
Oh, this is the Noomi Rapace.
Seven
twins or something like that. Isn't the alternate days of the week?
So
I did not know about this. Is this a Netflix film or is a film on Netflix?
This is a Netflix film. It's directed by Tommy Vercola, who directed the Nazi zombie...
Dead Snow, is it?
Dead Snow, yeah. Oh, yeah. And Hansel and Gretel... Witch Hunters, yeah. So that gives you kind of...
the zone that we're aiming
the zone.
At here.
It's produced actually by Raffaella De Laurinaitis. That's the daughter of Dino. So, I mean, she has her own track record as a producer. She did the Conan movies.
I mean, it was a sort of a family thing, if I remember correctly. Like Hannibal as well. Is that one of the ones? Was it Hannibal?
They did family of the Laurinaitis behind the Hannibal kind of thing, weren't
franchise,
they?
Yeah.
She produced Dune and Dragonheart, so kind of an up and down. But, you know, she has her own track record as a producer. But, again, it's kind of an indication... of the
quality or the
level of character. Schlock that what happens to Monday aspires to. It's the premise of it is that it's a dystopian future where siblings are outlawed, because as in an effort to curb overpopulation, the governments of the world turn to genetically modified crops. And the genetically modified crops had the side effect of producing a very large number of identical siblings.
Okay.
So the problem was just getting worse with regards to overpopulation. So worldwide, siblings were banned. So it's like a one-child policy. And if you have a sibling, you have to declare it to this mysterious, obviously evil bureau. And they take your child and they cryogenically freeze them until the problem... It's like...
This is kind of like a...
It's like a
science fiction
Frink
from
the Simpsons kind of way
but
of solving problems.
Science fiction version of a Chinese government policy of years back kind of extrapolated into kind of...
It
future.
Has that sort of like, like schlock B-movie meets government bureaucracy style.
It's,
sort of like,
the first 10 minutes are like, this is the premise. It's really kind of tripping over itself to explain itself. It's no surprise really that this was on the blacklist for several years.
Well, is it, or is it a surprise that it was on the blacklist at all?
I don't have much time for The Blacklist or films that try to hype themselves up by
the
saying
Blacklist
that
is interesting
on the
in that regard, because any time you see it, it adds a veneer of prestige to films for some reason.
But then,
and then
watch
when you watch the films that are made from,
because the films that are on the Blacklist are pitches, not scripts. Like that's.
Yeah.
And the problem with what happened to Monday is that this is a pitch. Oh, it's an action movie with seven identical twins. It's not a pitch. It's not
really
a
high concept,
it's not an idea.
Is like kind of
like,
thing, yeah.
The actual idea of this is probably the television series Orphan Black.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which
probably
snookered this film in a lot of ways. But it's a, you know,
probably had a better actor as well, I would suggest.
She doesn't get a lot to work with, because it's, like I say, it's set up for kind of the first act, and then it just kind of goes a bit mad.
Yeah.
It kind of runs out of a plot very quickly.
And that's a problem when sci-fi is kind of trying to set something up.
Yeah.
Like.
What it does have to kind of distinguish itself is it has this kind of level of violence, because it's from the director of Dead Snow. It is surprisingly violent for a film of this type. There's kind of eyes getting gouged out and kind of brutal stabbings and this kind of thing. It kind of gives this film this off-putting edge, and where the plot ends up going, keeping in mind that this is a film about overpopulation and what to do with children that
wanted.
Oh.
You know, it has this conservative edge, which I found off-putting. I wish kind of that I'd found The Way of the Gun. So that's one thing that I've watched this week. I don't know if we'll be talking about Hotel Artemis later. But
we will be in.
Okay.
Hold on. Let me double check. I suspect we will be.
I can hold off on that, but I caught that recently. I've not been seeing too many films. The other kind of thing that I've been doing recently is watching season 2 of Glow, which I've been really enjoying.
The Glorious Ladies of Wrestling.
The Glorious Ladies of Wrestling. It's a very charming show.
It is. It really is. I like it a lot. I think, similar to you, I've just finished the second season of it.
Yeah. It kind of, season one's big strengths were the performances of its leads. Alison Brie is great in it. You know, she's charismatic, she's funny, she's relatable. Betty Gilpin is equally great. And Marc Maron is surprisingly good.
And he's kind of that kind of, for want of a better word, bollocks, who's actually, but also kind of nice enough underneath the kind of American TV.
Does
that.
It does play very much to his strength. I don't think it's a massive departure from kind of his persona.
I'd agree.
In general, the thing that I would say, without getting into kind of spoilers for the season, is that some of the stuff that it is hinting at or teasing repeatedly between Marc Maron's character Sam and Alison Brie's character Ruth, I'm really not sure about.
I'd agree. But I think I don't know how much to say here. What I will say about the second season, I'll come back to your point, is that it does its best to flesh out the kind of surrounding characters, which are quite a few, and does it relatively successfully. Although there's still a few characters who still kind of, but I suppose that leaves a richer kind of thing for a season 3 or whatever.
Yeah, as Netflix series go, I think it's kind of. It's similar to Orange is the New Black in that regard, in that it's realised that it has a strong ensemble and it benefits from fleshing those characters out.
Now, it's kind of limited, I think, a little by its shorter episodes.
Yeah.
I think it kind of maybe hurts a little because whilst it's essentially, I guess, a comedy show, but it's not really. It's more of a drama show with comedy, I would suggest.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those modern comedy shows
where it's
short, like Atlanta, where it's funny, but there's a lot of heavy stuff in there.
I think you're right, and I know exactly where you're coming from in terms of the two main characters. I understand why they're doing it.
Yeah, I mean,
to keep a certain tension within the main roles, and again, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it.
So, but I mean, the I think without naming what exactly the plot stuff is, the reason that I would have an issue with it is that Maron's character Sam is presented as someone with major issues with women, like a lot of failed marriages, and he kind of puts that out very harshly, and particularly projects a harshness onto Alison Brie's character Ruth. Like he
particularly the early episodes of season 2.
He kind of he projects some of the problems that he has onto her and pushes her quite hard, and then that kind of goes in a different way. I think what I kind of give it a bit of leeway for a couple of reasons, but I think what they're trying to do with Glow both with those two characters and in general, is kind of explore this idea of these are two characters of the opposite sex in this in an environment that's, you know, it's women's wrestling, it's this highly sexualized thing. He's a schlock director, she's a struggling actress. It's kind of setting up this idea of respect developing between these two people who aren't used at all to receiving respect from the opposite sex. So as that kind of plays out, I think going into season three, I would give them the benefit of the doubt, but there are just a couple of eye-raising moments.
But I probably agree with you're saying, but I think what's added to it, for me, I'm watching it, is that a lot of the times, the Mark Maron character, and what's really interesting about it, I think, is that because he spent a lot of time making schlocky, awful stuff back in the day, this is perhaps the first time he spent an extended period of time around women, almost exclusively. Yeah. And I think the show was saying that, or certainly to me, seems to be Justin saying that, it changes how he sees the world because he's never had to...
He's been pushed outside his comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. That he's a man in a woman's world for all intents and purposes. And I don't think it gets deep into that, but I think that's maybe it's his long game.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting in terms of how a kind of male character, particularly in the time of the 80s kind of thing, which were very much
like
of a time.
Like, make it sound so long ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it was certainly an archetype kind of thing, character. And I think it's doing something with that, which I think is interesting. I think it calls around to how he almost fights himself because he doesn't want to change, but then invariably, because of another character in the show, he does change.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting in that regard. I think, and I'd give it a benefit of doubt, as you say, to see how it plays out in that sense.
I think, I mean, the whole show really kind of grew out of the documentary about the real life Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling,
which I've yet to watch, actually, which is on
the 1980s. So I think That's why, you know, and it's a show that is ran by women. Most episodes are written by women or directed by women. So
yeah, there's a lot of
for that reason, I would give this more kind of a
leeway
than I would with other shows.
I think it's going the right direction, but there are issues. Like, there are a couple of things I'd agree.
Yeah.
Alright. So, Jay, what have you been watching this week?
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I've actually watched kind of a lot.
Yeah, well, I suspect a lot of what you and I may have watched may come up at some point.
Yes, so we will skip beyond that. But a few I'll mention. First I'll mention, I watched a film called Chronicle of a Summer, which is a French kind of documentary from, I think, 1960-61. It's kind of the forerunner to kind of cinema verite, kind of on the streets, real interviews, kind of a kind of predates the kind of Maisels and stuff in America. And it's basically these two guys, two kind of middle-aged, kind of philosophical, archetype French guys smoking cigarettes, talking about, you know, life and stuff. So actually, they're in the film to start talking with their friends about, we're going to make a documentary. So it's very reflexive, it's very knowing, very meta, even in, this is like 60 years ago or whatever. And they're talking about, you know, we'll go on the streets and we'll ask people, are they happy? And why are they happy? And are you happy in life and stuff like that? That's the kind of premise of it, right?
Yeah,
so they get their friend, who's a young kind of younger lady, to kind of get the microphone and go on the streets. And it's kind of weird because on the streets, nobody, I don't think they're used to microphones being shoved in their face
in the 60s,
'60s. So it's all people going by. It's like, I will not talk about my feelings or whether I'm happy. You know, it's a kind of that kind of rigid kind of societal kind of thing going on. But eventually they end up talking to some people, and they get one particular old man, which is fascinating to me, because he was 79, and he's like, of course I'm not happy. I'm 79, I'm an old man, you know, what's to be happy about? Oh, I was born in 82. And I was thinking to myself, fucking 80 in 82, like, it's like, yeah. Jesus, there's a reach from, like, way back. So it kind of hints at this, right? But then it kind of drills down and gets into where I think essentially they talk about the cinema truth, but essentially most of the people they talk about would be friends or acquaintances of the directors, right? So they're not plucked off the street.
They're not random.
But they don't really kind of lie about it as such, but they don't really
bring
kind
it
of get
it
yet. So they talk to people, and the conversations they have are really interesting. They're kind of private and kind of get at darker subjects than you would think for the time. And it kind of has a little pivot around midway point where it kind of touched on the Holocaust, which is at that point was only like 16, 17 years ago before that time point. Yeah. Like, so it's not even a generation. But also, it kind of talks about the Algerian War that France was engaged in at the time. and which also predates, and it's, and I think it's nudging towards the May 68 riots and stuff like that, and the kind of French kind of societal guilt and stuff like that about various things. So it's a lot going on even around it, despite even the straightforward conversations, which are really interesting. And it kind of culminates in this kind of a screening of the documentary with the people in the audience watching it. And this is part of the documentary.
This is
Charlie Kaufman-esque almost. And you kind of talk, and then people after, the director asks their reactions, like, that's not true. That's not true cinema. What the hell are you talking about? This is so staged. Like, you know, it's like this kind of stuff going on. It's like, and it's really interesting. And they kind of ask themselves, what do we get out of this? Like, and it's kind of remarkable in terms of it's almost writing cinema language.
At that stage, it would have been,
Like, I mean, it certainly may or may not be the first, but it's certainly
among the first.
And it's a really fascinating snapshot of a country in flux, I suspect, or certainly a certain middle class in flux at certain points. And it brings in kind of younger guys from kind of African nations and stuff. And how do you even talk about, like, black people is really interesting because it's very impersonal. So it's kind of like, it wouldn't fly now.
Yeah.
You know, but in 1961 or whatever, this kind of, it's a little more.
It was
kind
the acceptance.
Of, exactly. But but you do talk to young African men that live in France and do get their experience. So it's kind of ahead of its time, I guess, in that regard.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. It's like,
well, I mean, you're talking about, like, the week that we're recording this, you've had the scandal with, like, France and the French ambassador to the US talking to Trevor Noah about the legacy of colonialism and the idea of, like, you know, African identity within France. So it's not as if...
It's a subject that has never gone away.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you see it in Haneke's work quite a bit. He addressed it explicitly in... what the hell's the film... Cachet. He addressed it explicitly, but it's in that kind of French colonial bourgeois guilt across kind of a lot of French filmmakers, particularly in the last 30 years. But it's really good, really well worth seeing if you can track it down. Very, very interesting. Go from that to one of my favourite films that I have two films that if I come upon them on TV at any point in the film, I'll watch them, right? There's two. One is Goodfellas, and the other one is the one I caught you tonight, which is Tin Cup.
What did you switch away from to watch Tin Cup?
Oh, I did. I was watching something else that... what the hell was it? The Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
The last Planet of the Apes. I don't particularly like the Planet of the Apes films. I know they're very popular for a lot of people. So I've seen the first two. So I was like... It started on the movie channel. So I was like, I'll give it a go. You know. It's like 20 minutes in. It's like, yeah, I'm not really feeling this. And then I see it on Twitter and somebody's like, Tin Cup is on. It's like... Tin Cup's on. That's how I had to Tin Cup, right? So I love Tin Cup. I love Ron Shelton films. I think he's a really interesting filmmaker, particularly around the sports stuff with Bull Durham and stuff like that. And he's done stuff with Costner before. And this is the ultimate Costner film, I guess. Like, if you like Costner, he has a certain charm and kind of funny. He's very good timing and stuff like that. And this is probably the best example of it in terms of Shelton and Costner tend to spin out a really good film about golf, which you would think is almost impossible, but here we are.
Happy Gilmore, thank you very much. Well,
I do like, actually, you know, in fairness, alright, I'm going to retract that statement, but you think of a sport that's not exactly my style, but Tin Cup is terrific, really terrific. It's funny, it has one of the great central romances in the last like 20 something years in film between Costner and Rene Russo, who's great.
Russo is always great.
She's always great. She's fantastic and always has been. As like one of the great sleazy Don Johnson roles that in this one, it was great.
You say that as if there's a great Don Johnson role that isn't inherently sleazy.
Oh no, but this is a particularly good one, you know? But it's consistently funny. As Cheech Marin doing good stuff. It's just really, really good.
That actually kind of bring up those other two golf films. Is there a good golf film that doesn't kind of... That's
yes.
a comedy.
The Legend of Bagger Vance.
That don't celebrate golf so much as...
That's probably the worst one. But,
waiting for the united passions of the golfing world, really.
I can't wait for that. But Tin Cup's great.
I'm sure there's a Lifetime movie about Tiger Woods.
It's
going to be fantastic. Like the Royal Wedding.
Yeah, but I've seen Tin Cup about 20 times, and if it's on next week on TV, I'll probably watch it again. It's fantastic. And one of the others, I have two more I'll mention. One is... Still Walking, which is a film. It's a Hirokazu Koreeda, who's a phenomenally respected filmmaker from Japan, whose films people absolutely love. He won the Palme d'Or this year for Shoplifters, I think. He's made films like
he won the. Did he direct The Third Murder?
Yes, he's made Nobody Knows, Afterlife, stuff like that, After the Storm, or Little Sister, and. it's kind of remarkable to me. I've seen three of his. This is four films I've seen his, and the three I've seen of his haven't done really anything for me.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things. People are be coming out weeping buckets from these films, and I'm unmoved. And I'm generally pretty moved. I can be moved, like, but I've had arm's length kind of thing with his films. I don't know what it is. And people throw their hands up in the air when I say I didn't find Afterlife affecting. Where Afterlife is considered one of the best films of the century, kind of thing. Like, it's really, really revered. But so Still Walking was the one I watched, and this is kind of the fourth one of his that I watched, and it worked. It did. It almost didn't. There was a point where I didn't think it would, but it's a kind of a Ozu like, which it kind of a lot of films are. His films are kind of that kind
there's
of family meal
sort of,
kind of generations kind of getting together,
relaxed pacing, sort of enjoying the
then the underlying tensions within that family kind of stuff, and it is kind of big, but there's a kind of tragedy at the center of it. That kind of is kind of remarked on early, but then it kind of slowly feeds into the kind of story. And it gets that stuff about memory, about how people, if you die, say, you're given a sort of status, and stories become about that person, even if you were the central part of it, like in family terms, remember when such and such did that, and the person is alive, like, that was actually me.
Yeah.
You know, so there's this kind of, it gets that kind of family guilt and thoughts about how guilty you are that you're the one that's still alive if your sibling has passed or vice versa, and it gets it, but it does really well, very subtle, very kind of restrained, but quite emotional. I really liked it. It's a lot going on, and it worked, and I'm really glad it worked, because people I think were like, what is wrong with you, you monster, how could you not like these films? But there's still a couple more that I've been recommended, so I'll get to them at some point, but recommended. And apparently all the rest of the films are recommended, just not by me. And then finally I'll finish with, I saw First Reformed yesterday, which Darren...
This is going to be an interesting one.
Which Ronan and Philip talked about at length a bit last week.
Yeah.
And I did want to catch, because I am a Schrader fan. And I came into cinema yesterday and I was like, okay, I'm going to need a bit of time with this. I couldn't organise my thoughts on it. I know you've seen it, and you weren't as big on it as Philip
as either of them
and Ronan were.
Yeah.
And in the weird Darren sits in the fence role, I'm going to take a Jay sits in the fence role a little bit, in the sense that I would largely agree with what they said, but I can understand your kind of hesitation with it.
Yeah, my issue with it comes down to the fact that it sets out to do something very clever, which is to look at Schrader's Taxi Driver as a formative work, a work that sort of shapes everything that he's done since and casts this huge shadow. And so it's something that he has to engage with and approach it in like a 21st century context. So where you're moving it away from, you know, the 70s and New York in particular, and trying to do something
in a different world.
That's it, literally in a different world, but in a different idea of masculinity, in a different idea of like cultural strife, in a different like
of faith,
of
even
faith
like,
and belief. Yeah, it's more overtly religious. I mean, not that Taxi Driver wasn't religious, as we discussed last week.
Yeah.
My issue with it is that it, at a certain point, almost stops being a different version of Taxi Driver and starts veering as close as it can to just being Taxi Driver for me. Like, it feels like it goes over the edge. It has this wonderful tension that runs through the first 30, 40 minutes of it. And then it sort of commits, and in committing, it feels to me like it betrays its premise to a certain extent.
I don't 100% agree with that, but I absolutely hear that. I found it, I think it's a really interesting, I think it's probably a summation of Schrader's entire preoccupation. And like you say, Taxi Driver, and you're absolutely right, but some things like Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe have explored similar kind of areas and similar endings in some ways. Not explicitly so, but certainly around similar kind of retribution or kind of ideas of kind of saving and things like that. Like,
that's it, basically of masculine and identity.
I think Schrader's looking back at his own legacy and coming to terms with his own cinematic legacy here. I think this is his grand statement on what he's been trying to say.
I think
that's fair.
I agree with that entirely.
But I think it's really spare. There's not a huge amount of dialogue in it. Even like a lot of the stuff is about furrowed brows and kind of sad faces
and glances.
Yeah,
holding the camera in that nice Academy ratio at sort of Ethan Hawke's face as he reacts.
Low down as well, so you can see kind of look, that kind of
almost sort of
kind of super. And it's like it's full of despair, but it's a really interesting investigation of how we kind of contemplate faith in a world that.
Yeah.
And it does get out with environmental concerns, but it kind of drops them obviously.
Yeah, because they're not the primary focus.
But I think what he does get at with that is the idea of a world that's probably spiraling out of control and probably ending.
Yeah.
In a kind of very real way. Like, at whatever point, caused by whatever.
Yeah, and the idea that the literal end is transposed with the sort of metaphorical end that individuals are experiencing.
I think the mirroring of Tax Driver is really interesting, and I think it's kind of astounding. In terms of it explicitly calls it to mind on two or three occasions, like very explicitly.
Yes, yeah.
Like it's not hiding it. Yeah. And I don't think it's not copying it in the way that Schrader doesn't need to copy it. He's not doing it for...
But Taxi Driver is so iconic and influential that even like anything short of a passing nod or wink to it becomes caught in its gravity.
You understand, but I disagree in the sense that there's a shot in Taxi Driver... And I don't think this is a spoiler in any real way. There's a shot in Taxi Driver where Rob De Niro has an Alka-Seltzer. I think he's after a shift. And the camera...
Jesus, Jay!
Yeah, that's
some
not... The, no, it's more the next theater film than this. But the camera kind of zooms in on the bubbling of the Alka-Seltzer. And famously, this studio executive wanted to cut because he didn't see the point of it and whatever, right? And that's fine. That's why the boy in 70s film and whatever it is. But in this film, it's really interesting because Hawk likes whiskey and quite a bit of it in it. But at one point, because he's had stomach troubles and there's issues with health, he pours what's a kind of a Maalox type drink, kind of a stomach kind of, I think it is. It's a kind of stomach indigestive kind of indigestion aid or something. Yeah. It's like a pink drink kind of thing into the whiskey.
Yeah.
So he's having whiskey and that just as like, I can still have whiskey as long as I'm having this because that fixes whatever the problem is. But that starts to kind of bubble up in a way and the camera zooms in. And I think that's really interesting and really smart. I don't know if it's updating, and I'm not sure it's getting at something without saying it's not showy and saying, look, this is Taxi Driver, but it's trying to get at something in a very different world. And I really like that. And there's a couple of things later on where Hawk is looking in the mirror, which calls
obviously
to the thing,
most
right?
Iconic
but having said all that, and the ending I think is really interesting. I think it's brutal, it's somewhat hypnotic, and it's very much open to interpretation. In a similar way, the Taxi Driver is, but there is something. And I think this is where you're going to learn. There's something in it that keeps me at arm's length, that keeps me from loving it and thinking it's a great film. Because I think there's.
Watching it, I remember it feeling like a midlife crisis version of Taxi Driver, except instead of settling down and reflecting on its legacy, it goes out and it buys the Ferrari at the end.
I think I don't necessarily agree with you, but I know exactly where you're coming from. I think I'm somewhere in between where you are with it and where Philip and Ronan maybe have landed with it. So I'll let it settle for a few months and I'll watch it again to kind of, because I think it's a kind of film that would probably to some degree demand a second watch. And as I said, I do like Schrader as a filmmaker, and I will watch it again. But I'm not totally convinced on it. But there's a lot, and I mean a lot, to like about it. And mostly Hawk, who's amazing,
Hawk is great.
And has been great for a long, long time, and I'm a huge fan. But I really liked it, with qualifications.
Perfect. So very quickly, I watched a whole bunch of stuff, some of which we'll talk about later in the podcast. I watched Aliens in 70mm at the IFI, but we'll probably wait until we have Ronan and Grace on because they also went to see it.
Good idea.
So, yeah, I feel like with Jay here, that may be the best call.
Yeah, it's probably, probably right.
Outside of that, I rewatched Kong Skull Island, which is a delight, remains a delight. It's a wonderfully joyous film. It's a film that should not work on any level whatsoever. Basically, Apocalypse Now, but with a giant monkey in it. But somehow, despite having no clear characters, no real plot, a series of archetypes thrown together, and a comedic performance from John C. Reilly, it kind of coheres into this like hypnotic music video, sort of like pulpy, funny thing that works thematically, but also works moment to moment. It's full of these wonderful small little shots and small little details that keep the whole thing from falling apart, while it has a big enough idea of what it's doing that it manages not to completely collapse in on itself.
I want to revisit it soon. I saw it when it came out and I liked it okay. I wasn't mad about it, but I'd like to revisit it in light of Godzilla, King of the Monsters,
the trailer for which came out recently,
and which I'm really excited for, based on that trailer.
It's an interesting
trailer. I'm not,
trailer.
Because of Godzilla, mostly.
It's very much shed the Godzilla influence, aside from Sally Hawkins and Ken Watanabe, which is the best thing you could keep from that film.
Not to derail too much, but I really like Gareth Edwards' Godzilla. Not as much as... Shin Godzilla or, you know, your kind of Japanese Godzillas, but I liked Gareth Edwards Godzilla.
It was kind of awful. But
Gareth ever sits on the fence.
But interesting enough, though, about what was the film again?
Kong Skull Island. Kong Skull Island.
I should really remember that. We talked about it 30 seconds ago. But I saw it a few months after it came out, and I thought it was kind of terrible, but I was very impressed with how it looked.
Yeah.
I thought it really popped.
It has a wonderful tempo. And it has you can tell that Voight Roberts used to be a music video director, because it has a number, it has a sort of a rhythm to it. It's things like the shooting of the helicopters with their rotors moving in rhythm. It's little shots like the jump cut from a character falling into Kong's mouth straight to a scene of like another character eating a sandwich, which was so impressive and striking that my father, who was watching dinner, goes, "That is a really good edit," which is just you know, if you manage to catch my dad's attention as a, you know, in editing a film, you've done a good job.
One thing that does go a long way for Kong is that it was shot on location in Vietnam.
Yeah,
and I was going to say before we moved on, one of the other reasons that I want to revisit Kong Skull Island is because of a story which is much more interesting than Kong Skull Island.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
The story of the
Voight
director,
Roberts,
who is a strange and possibly bad person in his own right, but he moved
to Vietnam. He became a sort of a tourist ambassador for the country. He fell in love with it during.
He almost inserted himself in as a tourist ambassador, as opposed to became. He's like, oh, that's where I'm being now.
No,
it's
very odd. It is very odd, but yeah, the story. Do you want to continue there with the details of it?
So, a few months, there was a profile being written for Rolling Stone.
Oh, well, Rolling Stone, apologies.
On Voight Roberts.
Voight Roberts.
And in the midst of this being done, he went out for a night out in one of Vietnam's like hottest nightclubs, where he happened to run afoul of international
gangsters
who nearly killed him.
They fractured his skull, if I remember.
Yeah. If not for the intervention of Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man stunt double who leapt into his defense, he might have actually died. And kind of following on from that, he and the writer who was doing the profile on him for Rolling Stone decided to try and track down the international
criminals
that were responsible,
and turned
for
it into
this.
It's a Hollywood
documentary.
So the Canadian authorities get involved. It's this kind of international jet setting story with a complicated leading man. He is
complicated.
Oh yeah.
To be specific, there are sexual abuse allegations about that director. You know, but it is probably a story that people are trying to sell right now.
I'd say it reminded me of, I don't know if either you read the John McAfee stuff, the guy that created the McAfee security.
I don't know much aside from the fact that he holds some contentious beliefs personally.
Yes, but he's also gone on the run and kind of thinks governments are trying to kill
him. Oh, I have read this.
Has that vibe, the similar kind of vibe of kind of...
like we've broken reality and we're all living in like chain reactions.
But there is a kind of paranoia that runs throughout both stories. That almost like these guys are so paranoid they invite trouble because you go to places subconsciously to find trouble, you know? There's that kind of like victimized kind of thing, you know? Which is like you know, Jordan Voight Roberts is going to end up in a nightclub from the start of anything because he proclaims himself the king of Vietnam nearly and kind of wanders around like he owns the place. It's amazing, and you're really going, good lord, man, have some sense of where you are. Though he loves it, undoubtedly he loves it, but
I'm seeing a Nicholas Winding Refn movie starring
his personal aesthetic and the Vietnam setting probably means that Winding Refn is probably the person making all those phone calls to make this into a film.
It's very
odd. Confluence of the most irritating working today.
I also rewatched Isle of Dogs, which is one of my favorite films of the year so far, and it was a strange one to revisit in large part not because I changed or because the film had changed, but because the world had changed. It is a movie that is basically about the separation of beloved pets from their families and sent to an island overseas where they're left to scourge and scrounge. And basically, a little boy sets out to rescue his beloved family pet and to bring him home.
This is incredibly on the nose news-wise, isn't it?
This is incredibly on the nose considering when it was released. The shots of this, of beloved family pets being basically families being separated and locked in cages, shipped overseas and gotten rid of by a political establishment that's anti-intellectual to the point where they're running against the science party. It feels really uncanny and uncomfortable watching it now, months after it's been released. It's also in the time since I'd rewatched Grand Budapest Hotel, which is another movie that has gotten significantly darker as the world around it has gotten darker. It always had a host of kind of touching on like anti-immigration and xenophobia and obviously fascist.
Yeah, the Holocaust is it's in the background. It's there,
and it was there when it was pointed out. I think the Atlantic, I think like Christopher Orr pointed out that it is a Holocaust movie.
I found it quite moving in that regard because even when I saw Forceman come to the cinema, I found it that there was a loss at the end of it that was very much attributed to incalculable loss
sort of
thing.
The sort of the suffering of Europe and all that sort of stuff. And it's weird visiting Isle of Dogs, which the first time I saw it was in the middle of the blizzard. The blizzard of '06 or whatever. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was lovely. I thought it was charming. I thought it was very funny. And, I saw a little bit of the stuff that it was doing. It's like, okay, well, its political messages. Maybe be understanding of other people. Don't be paranoid. Yeah. Don't sort of conspiracy theory monger. And rewatching it now, after everything that's happened since, and I say everything that's happened since, it's been 3 months. Yeah. In the past three
months. And Christ knows what will happen in the next.
In the next 3 months. Yeah. It was really, I always found it amusing, and I always found it heartwarming. I found it heartbreaking this time, which was very strange. And it's hard to attribute that to the world rather than the film itself. But
I haven't seen it yet, to my shame, and I'm very much looking forward to watching it post those comments, and plus likewise Anderson. But is Anderson changing as a filmmaker, or is this just a confluence of...
Because
it's an interesting thing. I think Grand Budapest Hotel, you could argue that it's awakened something in him, maybe. Yeah.
Well, there's a definite thematic link between the two. When I watched them back to back, it was very clear that this wasn't an accident, that he hit upon these ideas twice in a row.
I wouldn't have thought so. The point,
To make one accidental Holocaust movie is,
And then, obviously, to set something in Japan, obviously calls to mind Hiroshima and Nagasaki and stuff like that,
And I mean, obviously, the Japanese setting is controversial.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of...
this issue of cultural appropriation and stuff like that.
I could be wrong on this, but are those two films, Grand Budapest and Isle of Dogs, are they the first films that Anderson's written himself? I could be wrong on that.
As opposed to written by Owen
Wilson and Baumbach.
And Stacey Schwartzman as well.
Yeah.
I think
Baumbach as well.
And Baumbach as well, yeah.
I know that he worked on the story with Isle of Dogs and a number of other writers, including a Japanese, somebody from Japan who actually knew what he was talking about.
Which is a good thing.
I think certainly Anderson is, kind of developing.
I like that, though, if he is developing as a filmmaker.
I'm a big Anderson fan.
Me too.
I think Isle of Dogs was kind of, I would put it further down in my ranking of Anderson films. I did enjoy it, I will say that. I did like the film, but it just didn't quite hit me as emotionally when I watched it first as other
Grand
films
Pest
that,
did,
that
or
he,
even Moonrise Kingdom.
I think kind of on a technical level, it's stunning.
It's beautiful.
It's got really good voice performances. I think it's really interesting to watch Anderson, who's a director who's so easy to dismiss.
And has been
for his
by
quirks.
A lot of people, which I always found amusing in themselves.
Because he's such a formalist. Like you can parody his style to the point where you have like Spider-Man by Wes Anderson, X-Men by Wes Anderson.
Or the
Saturday Night Live sketch where Ed Norton plays in a slasher movie.
But see, this is the thing. Anderson is always stereotyped as twee to a fault and like twee at heart and just this kind of...
That's a nonsense, I have to say.
Flippant kind of person,
quirky.
But that's really never been true.
It's not. It's absolutely nonsense.
What you're seeing developing in Anderson's films, I think, is this growth from being his films are kind of about personal, kind of melancholy and unhappiness, and into kind of a more general kind of Grand Budapest Hotel
bigger scale
taps into a more widespread happiness and
it's
Isle of Dogs
the
does that
the
as well
of like a personal perspective into a cultural commentary
I'm a big I think since Bottle Rocket I've always been kind of a big Anderson fan because his characters are kind of heartbroken in very empathetic ways. You know, I'm always drawn in by his characters, and that was the reason that I kind of would put Isle of Dogs further down personally, is I didn't feel for one particular character or the characters in general as much in Isle of Dogs as I would have in other films.
But I think it's
still definitely I would recommend
Brett Anderson. I think what's really interesting about him, and Darren kind of touched upon it there a second ago, is that that kind of formalist kind of parodying and stuff like that. This is similar to the people that say that, you know, Scorsese's use of music in films is really lazy and stuff and hackneyed, and his cutting is hackneyed, until filmmakers try to ape it and do it. And you realise how fucking difficult it is. And it did it with Anderson. I think there's a skill that seems to be forgotten when these things are trotted out, these lazy kind of things. Well, and it's exhausting. Like, I mean, if you could do it, you would do it. It's like these kind of paintings in a gallery. But look, it's just two swatches of red. Sure, I could paint that. But well, why aren't you then?
And I think sometimes, and I think more so with Anderson, like when you see X-Men, Anderson, kind of that kind of thing, I think it's more gentle ribbing.
No, it is. It is. Because he seems like he's not a bad guy.
But I think sometimes with, you know, directors of that type, people kind of get this idea that if I notice you doing something, then
that's a bad thing.
You're not doing it right.
Yeah. You're not doing it right, or that, you know.
Whereas Anderson's quite clearly calling attention.
And there are a lot of things that Anderson does that are very noticeable, but I think if you focus too much on those, you're missing out on a lot.
Yeah, I'd agree.
But I mean, I would argue that's more than that. That's the appeal of what Anderson does. Anderson constructs these literal barriers between the audience and the films, in terms of, like, even in Isle of Dogs, you have the repeated shifting of, say, the translation convention, where sometimes it's, you know, written down, sometimes it's via translation, sometimes it's just dogs talking. But it's constantly drawing you out of the movie by changing the underlying principles of the narrative to remind you that you are watching these, like, you're feeling, and this is the thing about Anderson, is that, like, as much as you talk about him being a formalist, not only is Isle of Dogs about getting you to feel something for pets, onto which you are sort of like superimposing a sense of humanity, it's about getting you to impose, to feel empathy and compassion for stop motion inanimate puppets that represent animals, onto
so
which
two
you
layers
would,
of a thing
sort of
that.
Abstraction.
Yeah.
And I think that's intentional as well. And even in like Grand Budapest Hotel, where you have the aspect ratio, which draws attention repeatedly to the fact it's constantly shifting the idea that you are within a film, that this is all just a construct, it's a literal box which he's constructed. But the remarkable thing is you still feel.
Yeah, and I think they do it literally in Grand Budapest Hotel with the Mendels
things.
Like
it's
like a miniature version of Anderson's whole thing in one little kind of thing. Like, it's like, this is what I'm presenting to you, but there's a lot more going on.
I would quickly say that, you know, I've only seen it the one time, but I think you can kind of pick at Isle of Dogs, and does it need to be set in Japan, and kind of some of the cultural stuff that happens in the film are not great, and, you know, kind of other critics that I've read that would be better placed to talk about that have talked about it very well. I think Anderson has this thing where he needs to kind of put the premise at an emotional remove in order to actually get at the emotions of it. So
it's interesting. You know, I still haven't seen. I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
So these two films that are kind of developing his personal voice more, and looking at this kind of
bigger
fascism
question
in the world, you know, one is set in Europe and one is set in Asia, and I can understand why he does that. It's just that when he does that, there are other consequences as well.
That's a fair point.
That's not to belittle, say, the criticism of Justin Chang in Variety, I think, and obviously Rebecca Sohn as well, and various other critics have also made the point. And finally, I rewatched Gilda, which is a movie that is so close to being a great movie but isn't really.
I have never seen Gilda.
Okay,
that's all I got to say about that. It's, except for the bit of Rita Hayworth.
Everybody's seen the Shawshank Redemption, that bit where she does the shit with her hair. Gilda is a great example of sort of like a really good but not transcendental film noir, in that it's all the limitations of the Hays Code and the Breen Office, but you've got all the simmering subtext going on beneath it, but you've got a narrative that has to explicitly contradict all that subtext of what's going on underneath it. So you have this weird dissonance where you have this really dark sort of psychosexual, erotic, homoerotic sort of like weird psychosexual thing going on, and on the surface there's literally a moment at the end, and this is like a movie from 1946,
we're not
so it's not a spoiler,
either.
Where the detective, who's just spent the entire movie listening to these two characters talk about how much they hate each other with a burning passion that fires them up and makes them feel something tangible and real. Says, I am a sucker for romance. Why don't you two kids get together, run off into the sunset, and live happily ever after? It's a fascinating film. You can see why it's not held up in the same way that, say, Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, all the greats are. But it kind of gets at like a lot of the interesting stuff that was happening at the time.
Okay. It's one of those ones I've been meaning to catch for like 25 years and I've never quite watched
and
it.
And it has two kick-ass song and dance numbers as well.
How was Hayworth in it in general?
Like,
Hayworth's very good. I mean, the three players are pretty good. I think it was Glenn Ford's first film after coming back from the Second World War, which is appropriate given the movie's about the end of the Second World War in Argentina. Hayworth is very good in it. She's meant to be sort of flirty. She's in the way that film noir tends to other its female protagonists. She's fundamentally unknowable, and the movie plays with that in a way. In that there's this recurring motif of like the big musical number is Put the Blame on Mame, which is about how when like San Francisco suffered a massive earthquake in 1906, just blame a woman for it. The film's central argument is that the way that men do things and the way society does things is to effectively blame women for the shortcomings of men and for natural disasters. Okay. And so Hayworth's character, Gilda, is positioned as this potentially disruptive, unbalancing force in a relationship between two men, narratively speaking. But in terms of subtext, it's made very, very clear that the two men's relationship with each other is actually the imbalancing psychosexual
element. Yeah, okay. Interesting.
It's at once sort of aware of the classic sort of film noir tropes and limitations of the sort of, you know, the out-of-the-box femme fatale as opposed to, like, the, you know, the defining examples. But it's also, you know, sort of hemmed in by the Hayes office.
Yeah.
Like, there's a wonderful moment again at the end where she spends most of the movie running off with men and, you know, away from her husband and getting her husband's manservant, who she used to have an affair with, but now is heavily implied to be sleeping with her husband. We won't go into that. But where he basically becomes her chauffeur for all these illicit late night rendezvous. And it's really saucy. It's set in Argentina. In fact, the Breen office and the Hays Code meant that they had to move it. It was supposed to be set in America, but they moved it to Argentina.
Where it's much more lower standards.
That's it, because their morals are much lower down there. Yeah. But at the end of the film, they have to have a whole big discussion where the detective goes, oh, by the way, I did a bunch of research. Turns out she never did anything more than actually swimming and enjoying conversation with all these men. Isn't that nice? Doesn't that make you feel better? And so you have this weird...
I wonder if that was in the first cut.
Yeah, it's a very, very strange film.
A lot of films are compromised that time for,
well, it is.
That's what happens.
Well, that's the thing. Part of me wonders if a lot of... I suppose it's an expression of maybe the puritanical aspect of American culture, along with, say, Prohibition and stuff like that. But a lot of what you see about American cinema with regards to, even today, this sort of pushback against like ambiguity and nuance and this insistence on like very rigid and very straightforward morality and very simple sort of almost storytelling in a way is rooted in the fact that even when you were doing film noir, even when you were doing these films that were nominally pushing against social standards, you more often than not had to have an Argentinian detective arrive at the end.
A lot of them got away with it.
There was no sex in this movie.
Better filmmakers got away with it. Filmmakers did get away with it, though. Smarter filmmakers could send it all under the line and get away with it. Like,
all right. So we'll move to talking about the weekend film news. And I guess we kind of have to talk a little bit about James Gunn, although I don't necessarily want to.
I don't really want to.
No, I don't want to either. All right, so we'll move on and we'll talk about other stuff.
Maybe we should talk about him very briefly.
Yeah. James Gunn was fired from the third Guardians of the Galaxy movie this week after a number of tweets that he sent between 2008 and 2011 resurfaced as much as they were ever buried. He was fired promptly for making jokes about pedophilia, sexual assault, all sorts of horrific things. But the movement was masterminded by Mike Cernovich, the alt-right, white supremacist, accused rapist, sentenced wife beater, and rape apologist.
So all-around good guy,
all-around
Mike Cernovich.
Good guy, Mike Cernovich.
Yeah.
But basically, it's opened up. It's another front of the culture wars, basically. It's a messy situation.
It's just another depressing thing
that
if you are on Twitter, you know about.
Yeah.
And if you are normal and don't use Twitter, you kind of don't have any idea of, really.
Yeah.
I think with Gunn, I think you have to you have to allow for the idea that people can regret things that they did 10 years ago and can try and grow and change, even if they're 40 when they did things that they should have known better about. And it's hard for me to feel sorry for Gunn specifically.
Yeah,
I think he'll be fine.
Yeah, I think multi-millionaire filmmaker is not really much of a sympathy.
And like, I mean, again, and the issue is like whether Disney should have hired him in the first place, knowing this was in his past.
Disney obviously knew about all these things.
But he apologized.
Yeah, but it was brought up in 2012, the first time that he was doing The Guardians, and apologized. And again, this is the interesting tension, because as Luke pointed out, it is hard to feel sorry for him. He will get another chance. He'll get to do a couple of indie movies. He'll eventually land another blockbuster a couple of years down the line. And I mean, the argument is that if you could have hired somebody who didn't have this history, like say a woman or a person of color, for example, like if you hadn't have chosen this white guy who made a bunch of pedophile jokes online, you know, would that be a bad thing? But on the other hand, there's also a sense that he was specifically targeted because he was critical of the Trump administration. In fact, he was specifically targeted because he was critical of Mark Duplass praising Ben Shapiro.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I mean, Dan Harmon is another person.
Yes,
that's
come up as well this week.
He's deleted his Twitter and that. And again, I would say, even as a fan of things that Harmon has done, I don't feel sorry for him at all.
No, I mean, this is not the first time
Harmon
I listened to Harmontown, the podcast, for too long to
particularly the opening stretches. It's watching a person evolve, but evolve from something.
Yeah. And just today I saw there was an article on the Mary Sue, and this is where it just adds on to the cynicism and the unfortunateness of it. There was an article on the Mary Sue saying that Ryan Johnson has deleted thousands of tweets.
Oh, 2020K.
And what the Mary Sue is saying was, well, we haven't read these tweets, but we know what that means. And that to me is a very cynical and
I presume, is this what...
This is just I assume everybody from this point out is going to be clearing their Twitter accounts. They probably should have been doing it beforehand, but as soon as you land a big studio gig, you clear your Twitter account. It doesn't matter.
I think it's absolute nonsense, though, because...
I mean, if I was Johnson, I would have already deleted my entire Twitter a long time ago.
Particularly in this context. Yeah, no, isn't a criticism. I mean, in this day and age, this is the thing, where it's like, everything that you have ever said is now documented online, and... Who doesn't regret the person that they were 10 years ago in some way,
exactly.
Shape, or form? Like, we were works in progress, et cetera, et cetera. You know?
But as long as you learn from it, I think that's the thing. Yeah. It's like, if you're still saying a slightly less nastier version of something you were saying 10 years ago, you're still an asshole. I think the thing is, if you do grow and learn, I think that's absolutely fair.
And this is the weird thing about it, because it seems like Disney itself, and it seems like a lot of the commentators online, are treating this as equivalent to the incident with Roseanne Barr.
Yeah.
And the difference is that, like, Gunn, regardless, whether or not you accept his apology, whether or not you believe a person can change, that's your own personal perspective, that's your own choice. Whether you condemn him for that or whether you forgive him for that, that's your decision to make. But Barr has not apologized for what she did and has not acknowledged even what she did. She said she's made excuses for it. She said that she took medication. Said that she didn't know.
She's been like
this
for a long time.
Yeah, and she's been entirely like this and completely unapologetic. She's still doing this sort of conspiracy theory mongering.
Just on YouTube now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just like with, you know, the way that article was being framed was to immediately kind of look at Johnson in bad faith, which I don't think is fair. I think if he makes the decision to say these things that I may have said, they
are no longer matter of public record.
They're his Twitter
that's
as well, which
business.
Is also proprietary.
You know, I think you know, you have to make allowances that people could change. You don't necessarily have to support them or
grieve
facing consequences. Yeah. But if the consequence, it's just a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess.
It's a worrying starting gun for stuff that's.
Well, I mean,
who
like,
knows what
it, empowered, it has empowered the wrong people, and I don't know what it's helped, really.
Well, that's the thing. Cernovich has basically taken aim at Sarah Silverman, for example, and if Patton Oswalt on the next one as well.
But also, we've had the also conversation that Johnny Depp has rocked up at...
Johnny Depp showed up at Comic-Con at the same panel battered one.
And they have no issue with him appearing in the film.
Yeah, well, I think people did have... I think people did have an issue.
The studio didn't.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, that's Warner Brothers, but again...
Yeah, but this is the point, though, is like...
But there aren't bad faith actors agitating for his removal. Like, Cernovich is very clearly targeting people who have criticized Trump. Like, that's
the thing of it... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I can't remember which actor it was that was on Instagram. He had this big, long screed against Disney, and he was talking about, like, are you still...
Dave Bautista,
is
it?
Oh, this is...
Bautista stood up for Gunn.
Yeah, okay.
This is the guy who had a trauma.
This is the guy who had a trauma who basically pointed out that Disney... Oh, are you talking about Bobcat Goldthwait?
Yes. Yeah, Goldthwait, yeah. He was talking about, like, do you still make money off of Powder?
Yeah.
Directed by a convicted pedophile and stuff like this. So it's
afterwards, by the way. He directed it after.
Yeah. Still working today.
These are fair points and fair questions, though.
Yeah.
It's just a whole big mess.
It's a shambles. Oh, it's disgusting. The world is a cesspit. But anyway, let's move on
talk about Venice. Venice Film Festival unveils its 2018 lineup. So basically, yeah, it's an interesting and controversial lineup in a number of respects. But among the highlights are Alfonso Cuarón's Mexican drama Roma. Orson Welles' restored final film The Other Side, The Wind, will be premiering there after the infamous sort of Netflix...
Cannes debacle.
Netflix and Cannes argument, basically. Yeah. Which is interesting, which means that you'll likely see a release of it before the end of the year on Netflix, which is very interesting. I love the idea of there being an Orson Welles.
I mean, will you, though? I mean, I'm sure it'll be on Netflix, but whether they'll bother telling people...
I think they will. I think if it's... And plus, they'll have to Coimbra's new film as well to put on there. So they'll probably do a Venice special.
Which is now a film instead of a TV series.
The Coen Brothers one, which has been edited down from 6 1-hour episodes to 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Which I think is great.
Just as somebody moving closer to the grave. It's interesting, though, because how do you exercise that much footage? I'm just imagining, like, the 2 minutes in which Liam Neeson and Brendan Gleeson now appear in the film as a result of this edit. But yeah, it just sort of, it makes me curious. It kind of brings to mind, we talked about, like, Once Upon a Time in America. That was cut down from 6 hours to 2. I'm sort of wondering, are we going to see now something similar? I think the Coens are doing it themselves, so it'll probably be better than that.
Yeah, I would think so.
Would hope so. Yeah. Amazon, speaking of the other streaming services represented there, Amazon have got Mike Leigh's Peterloo will be appearing there as well.
Which was supposed to be a Cannes shoe-in as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. And also Suspiria as well, which is sure to garner a lot of attention towards the end.
Yeah, we'll see.
Call Me By Your Name still playing at the Lighthouse.
Yeah, the last time I was on this podcast, we were talking about how it's never, ever, ever, ever going to be showing at the Lighthouse again. And now it's back for
with a double bill.
Bill with Stop Making Sense, which you can see in Dublin every 14 days, I think.
Yeah.
At the Sugar Club.
You know, you're never more than 20 feet away from a screening of Stop Making Sense.
It'll be a really fun night, though.
No doubt.
They're two great films. What can you say?
Yeah.
In terms of Irish films represented there, Yorgos Lanthimos's The Favourite is going to premiere there
Very excited.
Stars Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone.
The trailer looks stupendous. I cannot wait to see it. And I'm a big fan of his last
movie. If I can tell a personal story about, film nerds versus normal people. I was on the way home from the screening of Mission Impossible, actually, recently with a friend. We went to see it together. And he asked me if I'd seen the trailer for the Queen film. And I said, with Olivia Colman, yeah, it looks great. And he looked at me in bewilderment, and he was like, no, the Queen.
The
Rami Malek, Freddie Mercury.
I like that you didn't even go for Margot Robbie. And
No, even that is too much, no. The Freddie Mercury movie looks alright.
I mean, again, that's something that we're not going to be able to talk about without talking about a whole host of other stuff happening.
Well, indeed, yeah.
Okay, so aside from Venice and in terms of other Irish films that are doing well abroad, John Butler's Papi Chulu is to premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival later this year, which is another good sort of Irish international show.
Better in the cup.
Yep. Again, Butler, I'm actually quite impressed with Butler. The films I've seen so far, I quite like The Stag. I really like Handsome Devil. So I'm kind of...
I kind of like both, but not few. I have issues with both, but I didn't not like them. You know what I mean? They're decent, they're well made. He's obviously progressing as a filmmaker.
Well, I mean, this is, in many ways, it seems a much more international production. Matt Boomer is leading it as well. So it looks like it's going to be a much more sort of international
production. No, good on him. I'm delighted. He's a nice guy as well.
Cool. In terms of other news, the IFI Family Festival is running from August 31st to September 2nd. Which is a host of basically family favorite films and new and old. So includes stuff like Captain Morton and Spider Queen, the live action adventure The Ash Lad, various other highlights as well, including Tito and the Birds, and a variety of short tales, Supermoto and the Skier.
Yeah, it's a great time. Take your kids. A few years ago, I volunteered during the family festival and there's workshops, there's like tons of things to do to keep your kids entertained, and the films are very good as well. Yeah, it should be great.
Perfect. All right, with that in mind, then we'll move on to talking about the top 10, everybody's favorite part of the show.
The excitement.
At number 10, it's Patrick. Pug, actually.
Haven't seen it.
I still haven't determined whether or not Patrick was a thing that existed before this film, which I think was a discussion that we had the last time this came up. Whether Patrick is a product of this film, or whether this film is a product of like some pre-existing pug-centric marketing campaign.
And all I know is it's at number 10, so we probably won't have to talk about it again.
At number 9, actually, and holding on remarkably well, Dublin Old School, which is doing very well at the box office.
Yeah, it's kind of been brought onto more screens, kind of because it's been doing well.
Word of mouth seems to have worked for it.
I liked Dublin Old School, but I can't get... I mean, I like the enthusiasm that a lot of people are having for an Irish-made film, but I can't get all the way behind it.
I'm with Luke on this. I'm about the same.
I have issues with the film. I never saw the play, but I've heard it's not as good as that. But you know, that's how it goes. They're entitled to try and do new things with
different.
I'd like to expand it anyway for a film.
The thing that I think with Dublin Old School is that it's a very good film about that relationship between those two brothers, and how that has kind of changed, and
the odds of running into one another over the weekend and having that sort of like intersection of
lives. The big hype that's been around it is that it's Ireland's answer to Trainspotting, which it A, isn't really, and B, the parts of it that are going for that are the parts that I enjoyed less.
Me too, and I think it does try to ape it a couple of times, which
makes us look like curmudgeons, but like
no. Well, yes, but so I'm fine with that. I've been one for years.
Again, those parts, I like, that's fine. They want the film to do well. That's helped the film do well.
Yeah.
That's helped people that I'd like to see do well.
I agree.
Succeed, which is, that's all good. Just cut the voiceover and I'm like,
I've discussed this with Darren.
Admire the commitment to the voiceover, the sort of weird stoner logic, convinced of its own profundity stuff. And I admit that I may be adding a layer of irony there that doesn't exist in the film, but I quite appreciate it on that level.
That's possible. I will make allowances for the fact that it's supposed to be an ironic.
This is
drug induced shite talk.
Yeah,
I don't think that is
to the people involved. Seems really deep and meaningful,
and to any participant.
It's also possible that it's just me personally projecting certain things onto those voiceovers. I am mostly familiar with Emmett Kirwan from his voiceover work in Irish advertising.
As most people.
He's pervasive throughout Irish advertising for what it seems like is the only style of ad that is allowed on Irish television, which is pretentious poetry about banks or fucking butter or, you know.
Choose a bank.
That's why I don't.
I linked those two in my mind too much, where it's like, you know, he's trying to make a night out on the sesh equivalent to opening
an account for TSPs.
But that's personal, but it is, it triggered that part in my brain that went, oh, fuck this, in the same way as AIB going, why aren't you opening it? Why aren't you taking it alone?
Yeah.
You know,
we're going to take it out alone, Luke.
It's a good film. Go see it. But
welcome to the Dublin Old School generation. It's made €180,000 today, which is pretty great.
I'm glad for it. I'm not sold.
This will have you sold. At number 8, it's Thomas and Friends: Big World, Big Adventures, the movie.
That's a big title.
This is remarkable because it seems that there has been a computer-generated Thomas movie released every year between 2008 and the present day.
What Thomas? Thomas Tank Engine?
Thomas the Tank Engine, computer-generated.
Oh, fuck's
sake. When I went to see another movie that will feature in this list as we get a bit higher up, I went to see an early Sunday morning screening of it. And it was aimed at children. And this was when I saw the advertisement for this. And myself and the people that I went with were like, what the hell is happening? Because it looks like a 90s sort of like virtual reality.
Oh, God, that's not good enough.
I've not seen it, which might shock you. But I will stick up for it on the basis that this is a film made for very, very, very young children. And Thomas the Tank Engine is well known for kind of playing well with young children with autism as well. Aww. Because of the way the faces are.
They don't move that much. You have the eyes.
They can distinguish the facial expressions for children with autism that have difficulty with that. I mean, you know, whatever. There's 100 of these things. They're probably not great. But I will also stick up for it on the basis that if children are in cinemas watching this kind of cheap computer animation about tank engines going on trips around the world and making friends, they are not on their tablets watching creepy manipulative videos on YouTube about like Spider-Man getting Elsa from Frozen pregnant and all this mad shite that
Do you guys not know about this? Because I'm obsessed with this. I feel like this is a nice segue from the Thomas the Tank Engine conversation. Let's go back to the YouTube videos. We'll circle back around to Thomas.
There is
what
kids these days, right?
Yeah.
They get given a tablet, they get onto YouTube and they're kind of left to watch stuff on that in the same way that kids my age would watch stuff on TV. What this has led to is a gaming of YouTube's algorithm system where, because very young children, it's just going to autoplay onto the next thing, and videos are being made from mysterious sources with nebulous intentions that display content that is not appropriate for children or is upsetting to children. And some of it, you don't know if it's being made by actual people. Some of it is it just algorithms taking various things from videos that children watch and smashing them together.
Is there no settings?
It's not regulated.
YouTube is notoriously.
No, can you make settings on YouTube?
As long as it doesn't have any sort of parental warning, which it won't, because it's designed to game the system, I presume. It'll sneak in under the radar. Yeah.
So you'll see things where, and it's like a computer generated Spider-Man, a cute computer generated, like characters from Frozen are a big thing in it. Inappropriate content for children. It's really weird. There are a lot of articles about it. There's a great one on Medium, so I would recommend you guys reading about it. Fascinating.
This is
going to
depress the fucking hell out of me,
right? This is going to haunt you, Jay.
Probably.
I can't do this. There's too much in the world.
We would get this when we talk about Thomas the Tank Engine.
I thought we were just going to talk about the weird capitalist dystopia that is the Isle of Sodor, where trains that can no longer serve their purpose are walled up inside caverns, and railways are dismantled if they can't serve their function to deliver.
This happens when Theresa May is Prime Minister, by the way.
Yeah.
Just to say.
All right, then. So, moving on. At number 7, it's The First Purge.
No, not yet.
Okay.
Weirdly, I've seen all the Purge movies, and I never see movies that people talk about.
It seems like with every Purge movie, people try to rehabilitate them more.
Yeah. I've only liked the third one.
The first one is terrible.
The first one is terrible.
The first one is basically a home invasion movie where, in order to explain why they don't just call the cops, they're like, oh, Purge, and that's it.
Yeah, it's like, let's go back to the house 10 minutes before the whole thing happens, and then don't give ourselves any time to sort our house out. Yeah. Because, you know, even though we know this is coming every year and what happens, we're very lazy about it because we don't really care. It's like, use our idiots, and this is a plot device, and stop annoying me.
But, you know, it's the easiest and laziest thing to do with films these days, to say that this is a film about the modern era and the Trump era and blah, 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 blah. And I don't know that the Purge movies are necessarily benefiting from going, well, let's actually do that on purpose.
But also, I think it's you can say that
designed by algorithms.
They're not necessarily smart just because they do that.
No, I think you're right. What they do is they comment on something without saying anything about something, and that's not the same thing. And people seem to mix it up.
I think that there is something to be said for the way that those fears bubble through. Anyway, I mean, I'm not calling them masterpieces. I don't think they are, but I think they're fascinating to watch.
I quite like the third one. The other two, I could take a leave.
All right. At number 6, it's Hotel Artemis, which I believe you've actually seen.
Yes, I have seen this one. I don't want to be too harsh on it. I saw it, and I wasn't mad about it, and then I came out, and I looked up its budget, and it was about $12 million, and I was okay.
Pocket change, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that cast.
Yeah, and, you know, you have to think that, relatively speaking, that cast is taking a chunk out of that.
Yeah, Dave Bautista was probably working for cookies or something like that, to be honest.
Yeah, although he's doing that football stadium under siege movie for Sky. I don't know if he has astronomical kind of.
He's probably getting paid across the board rather than.
But between Bautista and Jodie Foster,
Jeff Goldblum, Jenny Slate, Charlie Day, Sterling K. Brown.
That probably could
it maybe got percentages.
But I kind of was kind of antsy for action when I went to go see it, and it holds off on that for quite a long time. The action is very well done when it does happen. The kind of felt like a Blacklist-y kind of film again, where it's like
a premise rather than
an actual story. But having said that, the storyline that plays out with Jodie Foster is, because it's Jodie Foster, pretty good.
But that's the thing. Any
I came out of it and I was like, I didn't really enjoy that, and then I kind of warmed to it a little bit more. I'd say it's worth watching at home.
I might catch it at home at some point.
Very curious to see this movie. I'll probably see this movie in a double bill with another movie that we'll get to later on this list. At number five, it's Ocean's 8, which has done remarkably well. It's one of the movies that's taken advantage of the huge swath of sort of empty summer generated by the World Cup to earn 1.1 million euro at the box office.
I still want to catch this, actually. I haven't seen it, but I really love the cast, so I will get to it at some point.
I have seen it. I liked it quite a bit. It's an Ocean's movie, so it's breezy and it's fun, and it's all the things that the good Ocean's movies from the 90s and early 2000s were.
A.K.A. But, Ocean's 11.
Yeah. But,
and 13.
No. I'm not having that here.
And, you know, there's
13 is the best Pacino performance after Insomnia.
Good lord.
It does have a roller coaster of an accent from Helena Bonham Carter. She's doing an Irish accent.
The Northern Irish accent, yeah.
It's sometimes Northern Irish, Darren, and sometimes it's Dublin, and sometimes it's English.
She does a bit of that in films.
But it's kind of that, it's movie stars just kind of doing whatever.
Hanging out.
For the crack kind of thing. And it's enjoyable for that.
I don't see it. I'll probably catch it at some point.
At number four, which opened the last time I think you're on, Luke, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which has earned 3.1 million euro.
Of course it has.
I will not catch this.
Shite.
The
I mad shite. I was saying I couldn't figure out if it was good shite or bad shite when I saw it. I think it's just bad shite.
I have a soft spot for it. I don't think it's a good film. I think it's a really, really fascinating film, and I'm glad that Nosferatu but with dinosaurs exists. At number three, Skyscraper.
I've seen this one as well.
Yeah,
I wasn't mad about it.
Yeah, it's very stock.
It's a Dwayne Johnson action film, but it like the best action bit in it is kind of halfway through it. There's
the
all this
dangling, is it, or the
him getting into the building is the best bit of the film. And
once he's in the building, you've got nowhere to go.
Yeah, and there's these comparisons to like Die Hard and the tearing of
Rome. It invites, like it's designed to invite them.
But it very much felt like a kind of committee, or even an algorithm driven film, because it's Dwayne Johnson. It's the film is set
in Hong Kong.
It's set in the lucrative Asian market.
Yeah.
It's got actors from that market, but not in big roles.
But enough that you
it's
could.
Somewhat dive its arse, though, right?
Yes, it did not do particularly well financially. Internet Hero overseas as well, so it's not. You won't be seeing a Skyscraper 2, the skyscraping.
It seems like because Dwayne Johnson is very meticulous to a Cruisian level with kind of how he plans out his roles and stuff, but I think him doing Rampage and this in such a short space and time was a bit of a misfire.
He did 5 films in the last 18 months, which is exhausting. It's like it's market saturation. And I mean, there was an excellent article, I think, on Vulture where they were talking about how what Johnson tends to do, and it's different from what the difference between him and Cruise is. Cruise tends to hire auteurs or at least directors who know what they're doing and trust himself to them as long as they're willing to give him what he wants. So, you know, we'll talk about Mission Impossible's Fallout later on, but like that's an example of Cruise coming with a list of things he wants to do, finding a director who'll do it and he'll do it well.
Yeah.
So like all the Mission Impossible films are like it's a John Woo film, it's an Abrams film, it's
stuff.
Whereas Johnson, it's argued, and I have a hard time disagreeing with it, outside of the Fast and Furious franchise, which existed before he sort of latched himself onto it, and that sounds very condescending, but before he jumped on board it, he tends to pick directors that he can sort of steamroll. There's a famous point with the Rampage movie where he changed the ending of the film. Like, if you watch the Rampage movie, you will get a sense of this, because the ending of the film has this, like, weird 9/11 sort of, like, disaster movie. The world is ending. Buildings are falling down. Everybody's dying. And then you cut to the monkey making the sex symbol with his fingers and living happily ever after, because The Rock didn't want George to die at the end. The Rock was like, my movies have to be happy and upbeat. And he said, look, if you're not going to do this, I will walk from the project.
And on that point, the director of Skyscraper is... He's worked with Johnson before.
Yeah.
I think Baywatch or...
One of those ones, yeah.
You know, he's done 100 films and they're usually not very good. So, yeah, he has worked with the director of Skyscraper on something else.
Yeah.
And I think maybe he tried that out with... what's the movie from the guy who did Donnie Darko?
Yes.
He tried
Southland Tales.
Richard Kelly.
Southland Tales.
I adore Southland Tales before anybody kicks the shit out of it.
I think Johnson tried Auteurs and then went, this isn't my career. So I'm not doing it. I don't want to derail. Johnson kind of
weirds me out. Maybe you love Johnson.
No.
Okay.
I don't love him, but I do like him. And I do love Southland Tales. It's fucking superb. But anyway,
I think
we have mixed feelings about Johnson.
I think Dwayne The Rock Johnson is a pod person. He's creepy.
So tell it, Luke.
Okay, at number two, Incredibles 2, which has earned €2 million at the Irish box office to date, and will likely continue to be a monster across the summer.
Yeah.
Still haven't seen it. I probably won't. I'll catch it at some point. But
it's a fantastic action film, as you would expect from Brad Bird. It has this wonderful kinetic energy. It's got this wonderful sense of momentum that runs through it. Bird's like filmography is full. He's a fantastic director in terms of timing and pacing. His action sequences, they all work like clockwork. Everything is exactly as long as it needs to be, and it always has a nice sort of twist on the end, a cherry on top. It works beautifully. Works less well for me, at least, as a story, because it does the Pixar thing of the switcheroo, where it swaps the lead characters around.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work for these two lead characters because they were designed for their original roles. So swapping them out, you end up with a movie where, you know, Helen Parr goes off and she goes out to be a superhero. But that's okay, because Helen Parr is a well-adjusted human being who perfectly understands the work-life balance. On the other hand, Bob Parr, her husband, has to stay at home and mind the kids this time. And that works reasonably well because while Bob is arrogant and egocentric, he'll never go so far that he'll become a character who could be championed by the people that we talked about earlier in this podcast. So he can't be too resentful or too angry because that would turn him into a monster. So you have this weird movie where the central plot has no real tension to it.
Yeah, it is sequel-y in that way, in that, it's
kind we of... We worked through
fun.
Our issues, yeah.
It's, but I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I would recommend it because it's a fun family film. It's a very well-assembled action film. And definitely the kind of repetition of a lot of Pixar's favorite bits and bobs in terms of how to put a story together, bring it down a bit, not only in the way that it swaps around the characters for the sequel, but in the way that it presents its villains and, you know.
Yeah.
It's not as emotionally involving as the best Pixar films. But I kind of appreciated the way that because the way it works in Incredibles 2 is that Bob has to stay at home and deal with
his son's homework,
his
kids'
problems.
Yeah,
like he has to help Dash
with
his homework, and Violet is having boy trouble, and
Jack is developing powers.
A troublesome child. And I appreciated the way. In a funny kind of way, that it resisted the urge to tie that in and thematically, as a superhero thing. Bob solves these parenting problems through parenting. And I actually kind of appreciated that and thought that that was different. I'd say check it out.
It's a lovely, enjoyable movie. And it's a movie I was looking up. I've seen it a couple of times. I saw it on the morning that I saw the Thomas the Tank Engine trailer.
in a cinema full of children, and it was just an amazingly joyous experience. They just get the rhythms of it intrinsically. There are moments where there are almost calls and responses from the screen, and it's really weird because, like, there were toddlers there, and it's like Jack-Jack is an audience identification character for these toddlers, and it's great.
Yeah.
And I mean, we talk about this, like, the set pieces are astounding, and not just the big action sequences, little touches like there's a battle between a baby and a raccoon, which is one of the most magical, wonderful,
yeah,
like lighthearted,
like it doesn't have a great emotional connection,
no,
but stuff like the Jack-Jack versus the raccoon,
yeah,
bit in it,
it's just magic,
really kind of great family film stuff. And I will say as well that, because it is an animated film, it's beautifully animated,
yeah.
Pixar have really come a long way from the first Incredibles, which was good at the time,
yeah,
but the technology has come so far, and they use it so well here.
Yeah.
The lighting in The Incredibles 2 is gorgeous.
And the production designs of the character models. I mean, I've described it as Alfred Hitchcock meets Tex Avery. And that's if that doesn't get you interested in a movie, I don't know what will.
It's very Brad Birdian. And I just finally, I'd say that the short before it, Bao, is really good.
Yes, Bao is incredibly sweet and incredibly moving. It was really, really, really good. And it's a great example of Pixar shorts as like miniature storytelling, like in a very efficient, very clean, a very simple way, while still being incredibly touching and specific and personal as well.
And the character designs as well. It's
yeah,
distinct from an animation point.
What was the name of the volcano short?
Oh, Lava.
Yeah, that's
Lava.
Before we lavish too much praise,
we don't talk about Lava.
Yeah, no.
At number one, it's Mamma Mia. Here we go again, earning €823,000 at the Irish box office last weekend. Directed by Al Parker, starring Meryl Streep, Lily James, Pierce Brosnan, Colin Firth, Stellan Skarsgård, and Cher.
Yes.
Oh, and Amanda Seyfried.
Finally.
And possibly Dominic Moynihan.
Yes, there's
a lot of people in
it. Everybody is in it.
Yeah.
So I saw this yesterday. I'm really annoyed that Ronan is not here to talk about.
Somehow I suspect this movie
might come up again next
week. It might not be a one weekend.
No,
movie.
I suspect we could be talking about it a year from now. it's going to make
The greatest
fortune.
Showman to...
Yeah. It's absolutely terrific. If anybody has seen the first Mamma Mia film, which Darren has, there's a ramshackle nature to the first one that it's
not especially well constructed.
No, it's not, or directed, or shot.
But I mean, it has charmed us.
No, it really does. Like, and I really like it. I think it's great. But I wouldn't go so far as calling it amateur, but it's certainly a rough quality to it. And whilst that's part of its charm, it's nice to see somebody coming in and actually putting a kind of slick, smart spin on the same material, essentially.
The comment I've heard is that Al Parker, like, it actually looks like it's directed.
Yeah, it's directed very well. It's shot really, really well. It's a couple of sequences that don't quite work, and we'll talk about that next week or Rowan, because he kind of briefly mentioned it to me. But overall, this is terrific. There's a masterstroke. There's two kind of brilliant things to do with the film that makes it the film that is, and the film that, because everybody, I remember pre-reviews, everybody was like, how big a disaster is this going to be? There was a bit of a kind of collective nervousness before the reviews landed that this could be a shambles. And the fact that it's not is kind of great, but the fact that it's as good as it is even more remarkable.
I think there was kind of a balancing act between people that were worried, was it going to be a shambles, and people that are like, yay, another Mamma Mia film. Kind of,
that's a shambles.
It seems like, yay, Mamma Mia, yay, ABBA kind of has won out, and that sounds great. Like, I haven't seen it, but I really want to see it.
There's two things that does really, really well. The first thing is its structure, which, if you know a bit about it, it goes back to, it's kind of a flashback,
yes,
flash forward.
It has
structure.
It's the Godfather 2 of ABBA.
Yes, it is.
And it has been described. And that's not a condescending.
No, it's not. You get the first film, which is the main story, and then the second film basically tells you the story of how the first film happened. Yeah.
It's basically how Meryl Streep's character, played by Lily James, ended up in a situation where her daughter could potentially have three fathers.
Yes. And then
I mean, the writers have talked about this, like, that. Yeah. That's how they likened it to The Godfather 2. It's like their intricate, like, writing dilemma was to construct a series of events where it would be plausible in an ABBA musical for their lead character to sleep with three different men
and it's extremely plausible. Yeah. And it also flashes forward to events after the events in the first film.
Yes.
So, yeah, but what it really does, and this is how really well constructed it is, and actually well written it is, everything that happens really, really deepens what happens later on. They're very smart about, you get a kind of get a three card trick to some degree. You get the 1979, I think it's set, the original kind of era, informs the first film.
Yeah.
And then subsequently informs the later part of the sequel, like the older kind of characters.
So what you're saying is you want HBO to organize like a Godfather television movie style in chronological order?
No, we do not want that. This is glorious, and it does it so well, and gives characters really work. Like the cast director for the young actors is pretty remarkable.
Young
Colin Firth is a little iffy, but aside from him, everybody's great. The other masterstroke of Paul's is Lily James, who is sensational as young Meryl Streep, and just as her own, like, you buy her as that character from minute one and sells the hell out of it.
To bring in that Godfather comparison again, how would you compare James versus Streep to, like, how Godfather 2 approaches De Niro versus
but it does it, without getting into too much depth, it does a couple of things that kind of brings the character to mind, but it very deliberately doesn't. They're quite on the nose, and that's fine.
That's very smart, I think.
Yeah, it is, because
James is talented.
She's really talented.
To let it be a showcase for her.
But it's not a Meryl Streep impersonation. Yeah. It's not attempting anything like that. It's a young girl's odyssey rather than a young version of Meryl Streep's odyssey. Do you know, she will become that person, but she is not that person yet.
Yeah.
But she tries it on a little bit, and I think the movie is very smart about that. It kind of, it's letting you know very clearly what's happening, and obviously mostly in song form.
Yeah.
But then it kind of, all of that informs what kind of comes later, and there's various sequences that happen post the first film's timeline. And it's extremely moving, like, and it's extremely funny, and it's just the songs and the characterization. It's just, it's glorious, absolutely glorious. And then they put Cher in it. It's,
I like that. Which the Sherry on top.
It kind of is, though. It's like, you think you've had enough, you don't even know enough. It's like,
I'm very excited to see it. Like, it's very. It's fun for us to not be cynical about something.
It's easy.
I heard the film announced, I will admit that I was like, Mamma Mia 2. And I think even with the subtitle, they are saying, yes, we know this is a bit audacious. But Mamma Mia, the original film, made so much money. The cynical thing for them to have done would have been to make a sequel
cash grab
2 years later.
Yeah.
The fact that they've done it 10 years later, and the fact that they are kind of as winkingly kind of aware of, you know,
they could have literally just rethreaded the film,
yeah,
and sold the package again,
but
in a different way.
Doing that flashback, it's such a simple, but it's the perfect idea for them to do. It shows that they've put thought and
care into
this.
But they have, and I think it's more than that, though. You'd have to see it to realize the work that goes into making it work.
Okay.
Like, I mean, you can have the structure, and it means nothing if it's not, the characters aren't built in the right way to exactly push those buttons. And it may be somewhat manipulative, but it's the name of the game, if you ever know. But it's great. I don't know where they're going to go from here, but I want to see more of them. In fact, I demand to see more of them in the future. It's wonderful.
I like that. Well, the next one will be The Godfather 3 of Mamma Mia sequels.
Just when I thought I was in it. Yeah, no, I like, go and see it.
Knowing what I know about the film, I can't imagine that a third one will be easy to plot.
No, but I didn't think a second would be either, so.
Okay.
I mean, you might need another 10 years, but who'd be alive then?
All right. Let's move on to talking about the new releases. So, out this week, Hotel Transylvania 3, directed by Jendy Tarkovsky.
Yep.
Who's responsible for Samurai Jack.
Yes.
This is the Monsters Go on Vacation movie.
I kind of like the trailer of this. I like the first film.
It's reasonable reviews.
Yeah, it seems to be gone okay. I didn't see the follow-up, so I don't know what the quality was like there. They seem very spectacularly successful, financial-wise. And I like Jendy Tarkovsky, so...
I think I've seen the second one, but not the first one. And I remember not liking the story so much as I liked the old-style Looney Tunes aspect of the way they use the physicality of the characters, which is what you would expect from
the first one. It's much more enjoyable. I haven't seen the second one, but have a look at the first, it's good. And this trailer is great, certainly. I like the idea of putting them on a cruise ship. I'm in.
Yeah. Monsters Vacation.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen any of these, but you can tell, because he's done all three of them, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Yes.
It would be very easy for Sony to just bring on a new kind of cheap director every time.
Sure.
But
he is a great talent in animation. And but
I think the reason why he didn't, is just he rescued the first film halfway through, I think. Wasn't it? Like, the film was in serious trouble.
Yeah.
And he kind of, so he kind of wrote his own ticket a little bit.
Yeah,
on,
yeah.
Which is great that he stuck by it anyway, but, you know, and he hopefully got paid
for
it.
But it shows kind of a faith and an appreciation maybe for a director in animation that you don't necessarily get from big studios or wouldn't expect
on
from
these sorts of products.
Plus, he got to make a new Samurai Jack season as well. Yeah.
And I think he's re-upped with Sony. He's got another couple of things coming out.
Good. I mean, it's deserved, though, because, I mean,
I always like that. I like the one for you, one for me.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a very smart film. Like, I mean, Samurai Jack's very...
Oh, yeah.
I'm a huge fan. Like, and I had them since I saw it a long time ago. It's great. And I like the new season of it. And I'm glad he's getting his day. Like, well-deserved.
He's not doing the Clone Wars that they're bringing back.
I don't think he's involved in the revival of it.
No, yeah. But
because he only did the shorts, didn't he? He didn't do the TV show, did he?
Did he not do the TV show?
He did one season of the TV show.
Okay.
Because I know that he did the shorts that inspired the TV show. I didn't know that he did the... Also out this week is Apostasy, which is the British film about a faithful Jehovah's Witness who's forced to shun her own sister because of religious transgression. It's by Dan Kokotajolo, and I apologize for mangling that translation.
I've heard good things about this. I haven't seen it, but I've heard really strong things. I'm not sure if I'm going to catch it. I'd like to catch it, but
there is a lot on.
Yeah, there is. But I've heard it's really good.
And finally, the big release of the week, Mission Impossible Fallout, written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, starring Tom Cruise, the sixth movie in the series and the first to be directed by the same director of the previous installment.
Yeah.
This is the big release of the week, and I think myself and Luke have both seen this.
Yes.
And I think that Jay, in preparation for seeing this, has watched 4 of the last 5 films.
Yes, I'm up to... I didn't quite get the Rogue Nation, which I will do before I see Fallout.
Now, myself and Luke had a quick conversation off mic earlier in which he suggested something that caught my attention, and I kind of want to bring it up now. You suggested that you figured out what the appeal of Tom Cruise was.
Yes. This is my hot take based on last month's clickbait, which is a very 2018 sentence. But I think that the appeal of Tom Cruise is that he has little dick energy. Big dick energy, you may remember. I know a lot of
you may remember
since last week.
Yeah.
My notes out here.
Luke actually has notes here.
But
dick is underlined by the looks of it.
Big dick energy was this thing that was going around in think pieces and Twitter feeds last month about people that had this kind of charisma, this personal charisma and this air of confidence and this ability to make the people around them feel good that implies either the possession of a big dick or the kind of vibe of a person that would have a very personal confidence kind of a thing. And I think
Pete Davidson, for example, has been cited. I think he's the root of the big dick energy.
Kate Blanchett, I think was another big one that I saw. Rihanna, people that are confident and that make other people feel at ease and confident and good, or at least it seems that they do. And I think that the thing about Tom Cruise is that he's so the opposite of that he's actually managed to self-actualize it and weaponize it and use it for his own purposes. And his insecurity is so strong, and his need to please and to be loved in spite of the fact that he's weird and off-putting and bad is so strong that it actually loops back around. I thought Fallout was great. I really, really, really liked it. But I prefaced my review on Film in Dublin by going through a laundry list of the creepy, off-putting,
aspects of Tom Cruise,
morally wrong shit about Tom Cruise. And in doing research for that, I uncovered things that I had forgotten. I don't know if you've ever seen Going Clear.
The documentary, the Scientology one.
Okay, so I was re-watching the Cruise part of that in research for this review, and I had forgotten that he had Nicole Kidman's phone tapped while they were married. And even in doing that laundry list, there was stuff that I left out. You know, he once went...
Luke is checking his notes.
He once went 110 days without seeing his daughter in 2012. Like, a off-putting guy. But... Back to little dick energy. I think all of Cruise's best films and best performances stem from him being a character that has little dick energy, that is either a very insecure person, or that sees Cruise himself within the performance push himself so hard out of a feeling of insecurity. As evidence for this, I will point out, so the big thing with Mission Impossible movies at the moment, and with Cruise action movies in general, is the whole Cruise does his own stunts, yeah, and the stunts are mental thing.
Yeah.
And this has ramped up considerably in terms of not only the stunts themselves, but in the publicity of, yes, it in the last few years.
Yes,
particularly around this one where he broke his ankle and was on, yeah, the Graham Norton show, almost doing like a court disposition, and going frame by frame through the footage of him breaking the ankle, which is included in the trailer.
The only thing they really had to market The Mummy on was his big stunt in the plane that's halfway through the film, and it's a big thing that Cruise and his people push now. And you can track this back to, and we're probably going to talk about a few of the Mission Impossible films, you can track this back to 2006, Mission Impossible 3, which I know is your favorite. Yeah, okay. It's a very good film.
I feel better prepared for this.
Oh, yeah. No,
I'm winging it.
I brought my notes. I'm ready to go on this. Mission Impossible 3 is a very good film, but it is the lowest grossing film in the Mission, yeah, Impossible franchise. And it came out in 2006, which was at the height of post-couch jumping Cruise fatigue.
Yes.
And I think that those two things are probably linked.
There's a graph in his notes.
Yeah. if you're looking to do extra research on this, listeners, yourselves, there was a great video recently by the video essayist Patrick Williams talking about the trajectory of Ethan Hunt and the character of Ethan, yeah, Hunt. It's who is Ethan Hunt. And you can see how that character, who's very malleable, changes as the perception of Cruise himself as an actor and a personality changes from the hotshot, arrogant, such and such,
young, up
Mission
and coming,
Impossible,
sorry,
yeah, aka the firm,
to,
yeah,
this kind of aloof, godlike figure in Mission Impossible 2, to the family
the
man in Mission Impossible,
like,
3.
Yeah, the need to rehabilitate my image, like, you know, I'm a good, wholesome person, even though I've been through a divorce.
I got married.
I love Katie Holmes.
Yeah.
Aspect.
And then when that didn't work. And the reason that it didn't work is because, oh, Tom Cruise, he jumped on the couch, didn't he? He's weird. I don't like him. You can see how Ethan Hunt has become more of a driven, work-involved,
yeah,
and isolated and manic person. People constantly, in the last couple of Mission Impossible films, are like, Ethan,
sanity.
What are you doing? Like, Ethan, you're crazy and all this stuff. And the films don't
dispute that. In fact, they actually play them up. I think, like, one of my possible issues with Rogue Nation is that it's anchored on the idea that Ethan's unhinged, and it comes up repeatedly, and it's not something the film refutes, in that the film makes the case, it's not the bad guy making the case that Ethan's obsessed, it's Ethan himself making the case that he's obsessed with this thing that he may or may not have invented, it turns out he hasn't, but that he's been working so hard that he's pushed himself to a nervous breakdown over.
Yeah, and Little Dick Energy tracks throughout Cruise's career. However, the early films that Cruise was in are very much that, yeah, he's a very insecure person, Cocktail, you know, Days of Thunder and stuff, but they are, at the end of the day, isn't he great, though?
Yeah.
Isn't he a real hotshot? And you can see, after 2006, you can see the films that he's done. Also in 2006, sorry, I did do a lot of research into this. In 2006...
This is staggering.
Paramount dropped a production contract that they had with Cruise, citing specifically that people weren't as into Cruise anymore because of all this kind of personal stuff that he's got going on. But the films that he's done since 2006 pivot between trying to show the fun, you know, I'm in on the joke, I know kind of side of Cruise, such as Tropic Thunder, 2008.
Yeah.
Night and Day, which is not a great film, but it is kind of...
I like Night and Day.
It is playing up him as kind of a weirdo.
Absurdly over the top, sort of, yeah.
Rock of Ages, I'm in on the joke, bad, yeah, film, but, you know...
Yeah, I'm committed.
And to an extent, Edge of Tomorrow with Macquarie.
Yeah, well, the argument of Edge of Tomorrow is that it plays into that by letting you watch Tom Cruise die repeatedly.
Yeah,
that
the appeal of Edge of Tomorrow to a large extent
is Tom Cruise dying.
Cruise
over
going, aren't I off-putting? Like, aren't I weird? Wouldn't you like to see me get killed over and over and over again? And the answer is yes. And Yeah, it's self-isolation, to an extent.
Well, so public, public.
It's that kind of showing his fun side or showing that he's in on the joke. Yeah. That's half of it. And the other half of it is films that are determined to show that the Tom Cruise character is always right and, as Alec Baldwin called him in one of the Mission Impossible films, the living manifestation of destiny, which includes not just the Mission Impossible films, but the Jack Reacher films.
Yeah.
He's always right. He's just this ubermensch, you know. And I had another one. I think the Top Gun one might be set up that way as well, the upcoming Top Gun film. But it's... That's appeal of Cruise.
That's a lot.
That the appeal of Tom Cruise, he's obviously very smart in how he's
positioned himself,
pivoted that throughout his career, is that he's got little dick energy. He is needy. He is insecure. He's off-putting.
That's Magnolia is probably the crystallization of that. Yes. I would suggest.
Really, it really is. Even in a showier role. Show me the money.
Oh, Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire.
The same year, the evil twin of Mission Impossible.
Yeah. That's Cruise's thing as an actor, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you say that. It's worth remarking. The thing about Mission Impossible Fallout, and I love this as much as I realize that it's entirely...
It's a new theory.
Yeah, it's a new theory. And I think it's a good theory. I think it's solid. I think it holds up. How you plot a Mission Impossible film, and it's been suggested, and having watched Rogue Nation recently and having watched Fallout recently, I suspect the reason that Macquarie is the first returning director is because he's the director who understands exactly what Cruise wants and needs from him and provides. Like, the thing about Rogue Nation is you have this storyline about how Ethan is on edge, how Ethan's pushing himself, how he's, you know, the living manifestation of destiny, how he's both arsonist and fireman. There's so much quotable, like, Alec Baldwin dialogue in there. But if you watch the film, it's very clear that Cruise is having the time of his life doing these incredibly ridiculous stunt set pieces. I want you to dangle off an airplane. I want you to throw yourself out of an airplane. I want you to dive underwater to the point where you almost pass out. Then I want you to climb out, hop in a car, do a reverse car chase, crawl out of the crash car, hop on a motorbike, chase through the hills. And it's sort of, you can see that, like, Cruise isn't even, like, acting in a sense, in that it's Cruise on the motorbike and you can almost see him grinning ear from ear. Like, I get up in the morning and this is what I want to do. And interestingly, among those notes, is how the plot to Fallout was written. How Macquarie, who is the writer best known for The Usual Suspects, came up with the idea that he'd write the sixth Mission Impossible film. Tom Cruise came to him and said, I'm going to learn how to fly a helicopter. You should have a set piece in the movie that's based around me flying a helicopter. Macquarie's like, right, okay. So helicopter's the first idea. It's like, okay, I need to find somewhere on Earth that will let me put Tom Cruise in a helicopter and me put a camera on him, despite the fact he's only taken up flying 6 months ago. So there are like 8 countries in the world that will allow me to do that for insurance purposes. Okay, so, and the number of those that look pretty on camera, New Zealand. New Zealand looks pretty on camera, and New Zealand let me do this. So I guess the climax of this movie has to be in a place that looks like New Zealand. I don't know, Kashmir. Let's go with Kashmir. Okay, so the climax of the movie involves going to Kashmir. But then, if they're in the helicopter and there's mountains around them, then there needs to be a sequence where they fight on the mountains. And they can't fight on the mountains in New Zealand because those are so big that you can't throw them off them. So we have to go to Norway. And you see the sort of process of reverse engineering a Mission Impossible story around what Tom Cruise has learned or what Tom Cruise wants to demonstrate that he has the capacity to do. It's a remarkable, like, narrative machine.
But Cruise must be a dream to write action scenes for.
Yeah.
Because he does his own stunts and such, and because he, like, on camera, he is the consummate professional, you know, and is very dedicated. And also because there's nothing that you can suggest to Tom Cruise that is going to make him go, that makes me look too good.
That doesn't sound practical.
That's too superhuman.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, as somebody's pointed out, there, like, the supporting cast in the Mission Impossible films largely exist to remark on A, the physical impossibility of what Tom Cruise is doing at a given moment, or B, as you pointed out, to point out how incredible Ethan Hawke is. There's a moment where, Ethan Hunt.
Ethan Hawke is also incredible.
Ethan Hunt is. So, like, for example, there's, like, the character, it seems almost like Ving Rhames' character, Luther Sickwell, who is the only other character to appear in all 5 films. His primary purpose at this point is to meet the new characters in the film
and tell them how awesome Ethan Hunt is and what Ethan Hunt has given up and what Ethan Hunt has sacrificed and what Ethan Hunt loves and how he's the
only...
He
questioned his wife, the choice of wife and whatever the early film was. It's like, are you sure about this? What's she like and all that? Yeah, he gets a lot of it. Like, she better be good enough for you.
Yeah, that's it exactly. I'm just saying, you know, what you do, it isn't, isn't normal. I mean, it's
when
fantastic.
You come to me, she says that. Like, it's like, I know everything about you. I'll tell you what partner you need.
But yeah, it's remarkable. And again, as somebody pointed out, another like a common structure of the, like a Mission Impossible sequence is characters realizing they have a problem. Ethan Hunt suggesting a physically impossible solution to the problem. Characters other than Ethan Hunt remarking on how impossible this solution is. Hunt insisting that they have no other option, and Hunt doing an impossible physical stunt that makes Tom Cruise look great. And I mean, we say this, I really love Mission Impossible Fallout.
Mission Impossible Fallout might be my favorite Mission Impossible film.
Ooh.
I thought it was
Jesus, that's
really, really good. It's action-packed is such a meaningless superlative, but there are so many action scenes chucked into this of different types. The you know the bathroom brawl, the skydive through a thunderstorm, the car chase through
Paris, and even like the foot chase through London, for example, which seems like the film is almost playing with Cruise's sort of remember when he was in Eyes Wide Shut.
Even the car chase is like within the car chase. There is a
miniature,
there's kind of miniature sequences built into that.
But I mean, it's the final act of the film,
and then there's a helicopter,
which lasts like it's a 2 hour and a half movie.
This is where it ramped up for me into this is a really good action movie. Into this is incredible.
It's probably the best final act of a blockbuster I have seen in almost a decade.
It's incredible. I was laughing out loud with delight at some of the stuff that happens in the last 40 odd minutes of the film.
And
it's
again,
it's a great action film for two thirds, and then it just
transcends,
goes up and up and up, and ramps the tension higher and higher and higher to ludicrous levels, like, and then higher again.
The most amazing thing about the final sequence is it finds a way to keep escalating. Like, it starts at 11 and keeps going.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, I think that Macquarie and Cruise have actually said when they sat down and they wanted to do the Mission Impossible 6, their primary priority was that because the Mission Impossible movies are basically a series of set pieces, the point where you can explain a Mission Impossible movie by saying Ethan does X. It's like, okay, the first Mission Impossible is the dangling and the chase to the tunnel. The second one is the one with the motorbikes and the infiltration into the gang, into the building. Third one is the one where he does like the roof diving and the foot chase through wherever and the bridge attack and the Vatican. Fourth one is obviously the skyscraper, but it's also the car vending machine, the Kremlin infiltration. The fifth one is him throwing himself out of an airplane, followed by the opera sequence, followed by the diving sequence that becomes a car chase, becomes a motorbike sequence. But they found that like the Mission Impossible films tended to peak in the middle, and the sequence that you remembered from each one wasn't always the climactic sequence, it was the one in the middle. So it's the dangling sequence from the first one. From the third one, it's, I don't know, the Vatican or the raid on the bridge. In the fourth one, it's obviously the climbing of the skyscraper. In the fifth one, it's that underwater car chase motorbike bit.
Yeah, and with Rogue Nation, the big thing that they pushed again with, the crazy stunt was the him hanging out of the plane, which is the first 10 minutes of the film. It's a very good stunt, but
And it's played as a joke as well, which is remarkable. And I remember the thing, rewatching the series, what I actually really liked is that after the fourth film, they become a lot more jokey. And I think this ties into your Little Dick energy. It's the it's the guy who's trying too hard, but he gets away with it because he says, look, I mean, I'm only joking. I'm doing this because I'm enjoying it. It's like, I'm not doing this because I want you to admit that I'm awesome. So you have things like the little shrug that he gives when he throws himself out in the plane with the guy. You have the bit where he's revived after nearly drowning, and he does this almost drunk drivery sort of something where Simon Pegg's like, "Are you okay to drive? You were dead a minute ago." And you have this sort of like playful aspect of like, I'm trying too hard, but I'm not actually trying too hard because I'm cool, right?
There's a character in Fallout. Played by Vanessa Kirby, the English actress, and this kind of femme fatale character, and she thinks that Tom Cruise is John Lark,
who's this terrorist guy, this ominous villain,
this kind of mysterious figure throughout the film, and she's sexually attracted to Tom Cruise thinking that he is the dangerous John Lark. And because it's key to the mission, he's kind of honey trapping her to a very slight extent, yeah. And she kind of disappears from the film, and that, you know, was kind of one of the lesser points in it, that whole kind of character thread.
Well, the film presents him with three possible love interests, as if you could doubt his heterosexuality.
But
who doubts his heterosexuality?
I don't know, Jay.
It's not legally anymore. But so in that kind of, there's a very kind of brief stretch in the middle of the film where Tom Cruise is trying to be sexy and trying to be alluring, and it is so off-putting. It's so weird. What part of Cruise's whole marketability in the 90s was that he was one of the world's sexiest men, but him trying to be sexy is so weird.
One of the things that's interesting about Macquarie's work in both Rogue Nation and here is that he sort of seems to reject the idea, and it's not a political point, it's a creative point entirely, but he rejects the idea of the morally compromised protagonist.
Yeah.
And in Rogue Nation, he seems to be Macquarie's taking aim at the Daniel Craig Bond films, obviously with the opera sequence, which is very much like Quantum of Solace, but even the compromised female lead who's in too deep and is being blackmailed from all sides and can't be trusted. Whereas here he's very much doing the Dark Knight to the point where you have the raid on a convoy, you have Lorne, who's the soundtrack anyway is done by one of Hans Zimmer's students, but with a soundtrack that's very much emulating sort of Zimmer's style, and you have that sort of aesthetic that runs through it. But it's very much structured around the idea that Ethan Hunt is a good guy. He's not at all morally compromised or complex. The recurring nightmare that the character has is that at some point somebody might get hurt because he makes a tough choice.
Yeah.
And the film is structured in such a way as to say, look, he's not a morally complicated anti-hero. He just does the right thing at the moment that he's in, and it all works out for the best.
They are the whole series, I think, is very much focused on Hunt as an individual. They're very, I would say, kind of apolitical in a way that spy action movies rarely are anymore. They've kind of managed to resist that, and I think that they do that quite consciously. Isn't it more fun?
Not to have to worry about geopolitical stuff going on.
I think De Palma's one has a little bit of that. That's probably the last time you see it.
Well, De Palma's one has that whole end of history, sort of end of the
Cold War, but it does have a little bit of it. It's the only time
I
really feels like you're in the real world to some degree.
I think that kind of, it benefits them, I think, because they are allowed, because you can look at other comparable spy action movies of the kind of last 20 years or so, the Bonds, and they have brought in that kind of political relevance in an attempt to
stay hip and stay with it.
The problem is that date you really badly, or can date you really badly.
But also that action movies aren't a good vehicle for that always.
Yeah, and they end up kind of, in some ways, they're trying to make certain points, but they don't.
Yes.
I would agree, and I think the Mission Impossible series is better than the Bond films in general. I think it's better than the Bourne films as well.
Bond films are obsessed with this idea of why should we still do a Bond movie now?
Yeah.
And Mission Impossible movies benefit from what action movie should we do, or what action scene should we do this time? How do we top what we did before?
Yeah, the Mission Impossible movies exist because Tom Cruise has willed them into existence. There's no existential crisis there. Whereas the Bond movies are constantly so what's it like to be a spy after the Cold War? What's it like to be a spy during the War on Terror? That sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas this is hey, what does Tom Cruise want to do this time?
Yeah. And they have that. They kind of benefit as well from a low profile in public consciousness.
They're not smashed into your face.
Running through the series, they do take long breaks, don't they?
Yeah, and you feel you need one before.
There's rarely casting rumors and when
nobody really cares until they come out. Relatively speaking, because
it's so focused on him.
Yeah.
Everybody else is.
This is what I mean, where it is a franchise that Cruise.
But you're right.
Wills into existence for his own personal vanity.
Yeah.
But that benefits from gravitating around him. For better or worse,
you're right.
But they benefit from that.
You get the group of his team. If you just even look at Tom Cruise the wrong way in the film, you're probably out of the next one. Peg is hung on,
you've not seen Rogue Nation, was it? The one that you've
I've seen it, but I haven't seen it and rewatched
it. Cool. Because because they have such a focus on Cruise, on screen and off, and because you don't have the who's going to be in the next one, it keeps that low profile. In Rogue Nation benefited a lot from having Rebecca Ferguson
come
in and added to that, because it doesn't focus on her too much, but she's a really well written character in that film, and she's a great
and
actress.
Ferguson's great,
And I would say in Fallout, Henry Cavill again kind of comes in under the radar, and I think he's great in this film.
He's very.
This
well
is the
used.
Best I've ever seen him.
Interesting.
Use as
what
an
about
actor.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
I've not seen that one now.
I actually like U.N.C.L.E.
I don't like it, but I think he's good.
I think there's a thing as well. I think it's 3, Mission Impossible 3, where Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is in it, and I think there's a point in one of his line readings, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, where he sounds utterly bored in the film, or you can't sell it, and you just know at that point you'll never see him in it. even though you know it because you've seen the follow-up, you just know you're watching, and Cruise is watching it back that night. This guy's not coming back. He ain't going to be on the team next, because he doesn't shine the light on me, not nearly enough. He doesn't give a fuck about this mission.
Yeah, and Rhys-Meyers and Jeremy Renner are good examples of how the focus on Cruise does benefit the films, because where they have tried to go, look at the new guy, look at this new thing, look
it's
at Jeremy Renner, he's going to take over the franchise, it doesn't work at all.
He should have learned that from the Bourne movies. Renner should not be taking over anything.
Conspicuously absent he's from this film.
Because of scheduling commitments.
For a film that he also wasn't in.
That's a remarkable double scene.
He couldn't do Fallout because he assumed he was going to be busy. During the Avengers, and then he wasn't that
tragic
one either.
I think he got Doray Scott from Mission Impossible to do Wolverine.
Jeremy Renner's big film as the next big thing in action for 2018 is Tag, which is a comedy and a film where he broke both his arms immediately and had to have them CGI'd so that he could keep going.
He's had a tough
run, contrast to the guy that he tried to replace in Mission Impossible, Tom Cruise, who broke his foot in the early shooting of this
and
kept on going.
Like, the take is still in the movie. You can
because
see him
Jeremy Renner is confident, kind of, I'm a big Hollywood star. I break my arms, CGI them in. Cruise breaks his foot, and he goes, no, I'm fine. I can keep doing the scene. Please.
Luke is running in the place, by
please,
the way.
It's okay. I'm okay. The film's great. Look, it's great.
Also, Cruise is much, much more important than Renner in anything and everything. Like, I mean, you know, nobody's halting production for a Renner if needs be. Like, you know.
I do like the idea of wondering if Cruise had been in Tag with his arms broken. How different a movie that would
they would have played around it. They'd have made it work. And it wouldn't be CGI'd arms.
Yeah.
They'd have rewrote the script for it.
But I was really impressed by the way Fallout managed to balance the way that it keeps ramping up that tension. There's kind of this adage that you shouldn't, particularly in climaxes of films like this, cut between one big action scene and another, because it kind of cuts the tension when you're going from one big thing to another.
But
Fallout does that really, really well, because...
Well, this is the Dark Knight influence. That's your Nolan crosscut.
Yeah.
Again, like, it's very clear that McQuarrie is making a particular type of film in the same way that he was making a particular type of film with Rogue Nation. In that, like, the structure, it cuts between... There's three different sort of ticking scenarios going on at the climax, and it's paced, like, virtual, so it's like it's...
There is a lot of focus on who... kind of the different action auteurs that come in every time and how Cruise obviously is a big conversation with himself, but the editing in this film is really good. I think that kind of goes for a lot of
the editing was the one of the two people he carried over. McQuarrie got rid of the entire production team,
sense.
Which makes a great deal of sense. Because he wanted to completely reinvent his style, but he kept the editor on board because he really liked it.
Interesting. I'm really looking forward to it. I will see it. I'm probably going to see it this weekend. I'm going to catch Rogue Nation first and rewatch Rogue Nation first, because I really want to get them all on rewatch.
It's interesting, as Fallout is arguably the first sequel in the series, in that it carries over a lot of the characters, obviously carries over the director and stuff, and it becomes a movie about being a sequel, which is weird, because my crazy overarching theory of the Mission Impossible films is that they are primarily metaphors for different stages of the creative filmmaking process. That Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible is about acting. You have, like, it opens on a television set. It has all this sort of, like, performances and the masks and stuff. There's a lot more of that than in the later films. Mission Impossible 3, for example, is a film that's very much about writerly stuff. So you have, like, Simon Pegg literally explaining the concept of a MacGuffin
to the audience and to the cast. But you also have then, for example, a scene in which they outline how logistically they're going to do this big action sequence, and then have it take place entirely off screen, off camera, so the characters talking about the action sequence that's taking place. You know, Mission Impossible 4 is at, like, VFX houses, because Brad Bird stuff going on, so you have, like, this repeated discussion about the practicality of what they're doing, where Jeremy Renner's the accountant. He's like, okay, so your plan is to invent a virtual space inside an existing structure. How does that work physically? Or, wait, so hold on, your character, he lights a torch and he throws it down a river. How does that work or make any sense? And you have this sort of, like, repeating, like, there's emphasis on, like, working to deadlines. They infiltrate the Kremlin using a green screen at one point, which is one of my favorite sort of sunsets.
It's pretty good, actually, I'd say.
And I wonder if 6 is in some ways about making a sequel, because it's a movie that's very much nominally tied to Rogue Nation, although you don't need to have seen Rogue Nation to do it. But it's kind of interesting in that it grapples with this idea of franchising as it exists for modern movies, and how that's different from what the Mission Impossible series has traditionally done, where you carry over characters and plot threads.
What's really interesting about that conversation and everything you just outlined, Aaron, is that you can either deliberately or otherwise left out part 2.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate, I have to say. Because I really, really surprised myself by liking part 2 when I rewatched the series.
I still really disliked it. It's got a really mean, mean streak to it.
It does. Some of the dialogue and politics is a bit creepy, but
To sleep with a man and lie to his face. She's a woman. She has all the training that she needs. Anthony Hopkins, thank you very much.
But listen, I'm not arguing with that. But the kind of woo sensibility works really, really well for it, and it kind of whips along a lot better than I recall, because I really disliked it on watch when I saw it when it came out. But I actually think it kind of,
yeah, I believe bounces. This may be, yeah.
It is a bit silly. It's a little too long, but it's fun. Like, I had a lot of fun with it.
I just, it didn't glom for me in the way the other ones did, and it felt like Wu was pushing against the PG-13 rating. There's a moment where they snap a character's neck, and you can't either show it or hear it, so it looks like they just put him to sleep. There's a lot of really weird stuff like that.
I don't mind it. I think it works overall as a film. I think it...
It's also notorious by way of Face-Off, which is, and somehow less interesting than the premise makes it sound.
I prefer it's a Face-Off, because I've problems with Face-Off that I didn't used to have, but now I do.
Yeah.
But then it was a strange kind of, like, I much prefer Hard Target as well. But then that's a thing. But I said to you that I wasn't big on Ghost Protocol as a rewatch.
Yeah.
Which everybody seems to prefer.
It's just a string of sequences, a string of action sequences.
I just got bored. And that's remarkable, because I really liked it when I saw it first. But again, I agree with you. I think the third film is, by some distance, the best film.
What's the one that actually feels like a film? I think David Bordwell's written about it as a almost perfect clockwork sort of like film. It's the writerly one. It's the one that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's probably why I like it more, maybe, because that kind of appeals to me more.
The only Mission Impossible film that could properly start near the end, because there's actually an end to start near. As opposed to just being a set of sequences that are interlocked with one another.
Yeah, I don't remember how Ghost Protocol ends, which is probably...
Car bending machine. Oh, yeah. And Mission Accomplished.
Oh, that's right.
I really, really dislike the car bending machine.
It's the weird
sequence.
Moment
it's
where, like, Michael...
That is that... Ghost Protocol peaks at the hotel. And
yeah.
The car bending machine thing is idiotic. I actually laughed at it on the rewatch.
Michael Nyquist...
So stupid.
Going toe-to-toe with... Tom Cruise.
And he's a really bad villain.
But they're the same age as each other. I want you to contemplate
that. No, they're not. Well, they are, but they're not. Michael Nyquist is 35 years old.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Why is he in the pensioner?
Cruise is 1 year older in Fallout than Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon. Which is interesting.
Off-quoted now at this stage. Like, good lord.
All right, so I think that sort of wraps it up. We'll be back next week covering the week in Irish film. But in the meantime, if people are looking to find you guys online, where can we find you, Luke?
I am on Twitter at Mr. Cynical. That's cynical with an I, and I'm on filmindublin.ie.
At Jay Coyle on Twitter.
At Darren_Mooney on Twitter, and I co-host a podcast, The 250, where this week we'll be talking about The Secret in Their Eyes with Anya O'Connor. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.